Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from medical bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, another mass shooting and another plea from President Biden to Congress to pass meaningful gun reform. Chuck Todd joins us on that and more. Then your calls on Saturday's full reopening of Massachusetts. And are the walls closing in on Donald Trump? Cyrus Vance's investigation into Trump and his business has reached a new level, convening a grand jury to decide whether Trump should be indicted. Does it mean that Trump could actually be the one who will be locked up? Andrew Cabral joins us for that and more.
Move over gap year. Hello, closing the gap year. Parents whose children struggled with school during the pandemic would rather have their kids stay behind and repeat the year they lost to remote learning rather than advance to the next grade. But school administrators aren't having it. They're sticking to rules and research that holding kids back doesn't accommodate the abnormalities created by the pandemic. We'll talk to Paul Revel about this and more up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Brody, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Great, thanks.
So in response to yesterday's mass shooting in San Jose, Governor Gavin Newsom asked, what the hell is going on in the United States of America? What is wrong with the U.S.? How about fine-tuning that question? What the hell is wrong with Congress for failing to pass meaningful gun reform legislation? Joining us online to talk about this and other political headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press. You can catch that Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers here. Also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Good morning, Chuck Todd.
Well, hello there.
Hello, Chuck Todd. You know, it's sad to say that I can dispatch with this question and the answer really quickly because nothing's going to happen after this latest mass shooting, I assume. I mean, Governor Newsom says, what's wrong with us? You know, what's wrong with Congress? Well, this is like everything else. This other, every other shooting, nothing.
We're totally numb. I mean, I was discussing this with my own staff yesterday about how, you know, when I have to be on air for one of these shootings, it's just that much more excruciating to deal with, right? Any reporter, anybody that has had a report on one of these sprees, you develop your own, it impacts you in a stressful way and in an anxiety way, and you can't wait to stop covering it. You can't wait to compartmentalize it. I think, unfortunately, as a country, that's what we've decided to do. We realize that our leaders won't do anything about this. We clearly have, I mean, I had Jim Cavanaugh on my hour yesterday, and he's, you know, the longtime ATF agent.
Who's, yep.
And he brought up this point. He says, you know, we are just, you know, we've got to deal with all of this. We've got clearly got a mental health problem. We've got too many guns circulating. We've got hate and grievance being used, you know, in our social media platforms. We just are getting over a pandemic where people have felt shut in. I mean, we are a tinderbox anyway, and we are not at all sort of saying, you know, we've got a violent, you know, it feels like we have a mass violence problem, right? And it's either too easy, and the biggest thing is it's too easy to commit mass violence, right? I mean, look at this guy. Oh, he was bipolar. We've never seen this before. Somebody yeah. who's got mental health issues, who got access to guns and shot people up. Oh, this has ever happened before? Oh, you mean every other time that we end up finding out what drives most of these mass shooters? And yet we can't seem to deal with this. So I have no idea when we're going to hit our, you know, I used to say there's that, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, snakes on a plane. You know, when is somebody going to scream enough is enough?
Yeah.
And it wasn't, and it's just, but it really does feel as if, you know, unfortunately in America, you have to live with the threat that, you know, you could get struck by lightning, but you're more likely to, you know, you could also end up being a victim of a mass shooting because you went grocery shopping on the wrong day, or you went to go use light rail on the wrong day, or you went to pick up your kid from school on the wrong day. You know, I don't understand why we don't want to collectively not live in this fear.
You know, it's probably in poor taste to quote my favorite cartoon from the New Yorker ever, which was, how about never is never good for you? Obviously, in a totally different context, they're never going to do it. They are never, ever. I mean, we all said it after 26 and 7-year-olds were executed and they didn't do anything. And the reality
22
is,
states, Jim, have gotten rid of permits for handguns.
Yeah.
We're going backwards.
Well, okay.
We sit here and talk about Congress and we're arguing over a background check bill. For gosh sakes, it doesn't matter if there's a good background check bill if you could basically carry a gun without a permit in half the country. I mean, at this point, Congress looks that is the ultimate as Rome burns, The fiddling experience. Yeah, exactly. That's what it feels like. I mean, we're sitting here. We can't get this very modest gun control background check bill. Meanwhile, guns are basically being handed out like candy now.
Yeah, and we also have a mental health epidemic, I think it's fair to say, in the United States of America. But
there have been some surveys that 30% of the country is under some sort of mental stress.
Right.
Okay, mental distress in some form. A lot of other countries have people with mental stress. We're just the only one that has guns accessible to the mentally stressed.
You know, I was going to say in response to this, you know, how would you feel as exercised as we are, how would you feel if you were one of the family members of one of these victims?
And
I follow Gutenberg, who obviously his kid was killed was Parkland, right?
Parkland.
Was it Parkland or was it Sandy Hook?
Gutenberg is Parkland.
Parkland.
I think that is Parkland.
It is Parkland, right.
I mean, sadly, there's so many that it is.
Yeah, so many parents.
But you know what it makes me think of? Marjorie alerted me. I had missed this. I'm embarrassed. Officer Sicknick's mother. How do you think she feels when she's begging to have meetings with GOP senators to tell her? Well, you have the quote.
Yeah, the quote from her. And, of course, her son was killed in the January 6th attack. And he's not the only.
Or died right after it.
Right. He wasn't killed. He died of a stroke after that. And two other officers took their lives, killed themselves after the attack. But anyway, here's her quote. I suggest, this is the mother of Sicknick, that all congressmen and senators who are against this bill visit my son's grave in Arlington National Cemetery, and while there, think about what their hurtful decisions will do to those officers who will be in the Capitol protecting them going forward. I'm just filling in some of the blanks there. Putting politics aside, wouldn't they want to know the truth of what happened January 6th? If not, they do not deserve to have the jobs they were elected to do. So supposedly she's asked every single one of these people that are voting against the bill to meet with her today, and I don't know how that's going. But I suspect
she met with Ron Johnson. I can give you a little bit of update. She met with Mitt Romney this morning. He's, you know, inclined to support the commission, obviously. That probably doesn't surprise many people at this point with Romney. But she met with Ron Johnson, and Barbara Comstock, who's a former member of Congress, is helping her facilitate the meeting. So she's been going to the meetings with her and getting these Republicans to agree. And Barbara Comstock has some pretty good relationships, you know, even with the sort of the non-anti-Trumpers too. And so she got a meeting with Johnson, and Comstock came out and said that Johnson made it clear he's not for this commission. You know, and it's just, I guess I give him credit for taking the meeting. So, you know, but it is, you know, he's also the one that seemed to agree that this, you know, calling this, I don't remember the words he used, but he didn't think it was an insurrection, and he really is downplayed what happened. But at least he took the meeting.
So, Chuck, when the vote happens and they're not 10, the vote today, and they're not 10 Republicans, what are the Democrats? Let's pick Manchin as the most recognizable name. What is Manchin, who's mm-hmm. been saying we have to do things in a bipartisan fashion, do when he realizes that on the simplest of bipartisan votes, there's virtually no bipartisanship? What happens after?
Look, I think that it means they'll get Manchin down the road when they want to do reconciliation. I don't think it means they get rid of the filibuster. I just think it means Manchin will be there. and he's going to stick with the party on the other stuff. Is you know, those that think that this is somehow going to flip Manchin in the filibuster, I think don't quite, you know, I think what man, you know, one of the things you got to understand about Joe Manchin is and somebody said, reminded me of this yesterday. He learned how to be a senator from Robert Byrd. Mm-hmm. And the Robert Byrd school of being a senator was make your vote valuable and get as much as you can for it. And that's what Joe Manchin has done, right? And that's why West Virginia, you know, is always showered with federal dollars, right? And remember, Manchin replaced Byrd. Byrd was the king of this. And you know, I mean, look, do I think we're going to have the Joe Manchin Center for Climate Studies at the University of West Virginia, perhaps, right? And all these different, you know, the Joe Manchin School for this and the Joe Manchin, you know, whatever it is. I think that's what you're more likely to see. I just think it just means he'll be more cooperative with the party on party line votes, I think. I still don't think he's going to be there on the filibuster.
So to jump ahead to a hypothetical, we know a special grand jury's been convened to look into possible criminal charges against Donald Trump and some associates. If Donald Trump is indicted in Manhattan, does the sycophancy come to an end in Congress, or does it just ramp up even more?
Well, I think we sort of know how this will go. It doesn't ramp up, you know, and if you really look at it from 60,000 feet, Trump's support has eroded, right? If you look at it as a riverbed, right, over time, there is some erosion, but you don't see it right away. And I do think, you know, he has successfully, you know, I had this conversation with my EP right after the news of the grand jury leak, and I said, this story is both consequential and meaningless, discuss. And the point I was making is it's consequential. It's a former president of the United States. It's possible that, you know, I think the irony of all this is, do you realize had Trump agreed to separate himself from his own businesses, he wouldn't be the target of this investigation.
That's
it would be his son.
That's a wonderful point. That's a great point.
It's a great irony that his greediness to sort of keep his hand in his business makes him potentially the one who's criminally responsible for these falsified documents and tax documents and things like that. But I do think that he has successfully painted this with the true believer crowd somewhere in that 25-40% range of the Republican Party. But the fact is they're still, you know, they're the loudest wing. They're vocal. They make your life miserable, which is why they're holding the rest of the party hostage. But I do think there's a slow erosion over time. And I think that this is, you know, Charlie Cook put it pretty well. You know, it's sort of like Trump does the greatest hits, and the true fans love to hear the greatest hits, and they'll always love to hear the greatest hits. But you're not going to get new ears to listen to your music because he's an indicted former president of the United States, right? So this will do long term, but I don't, this is not going to be off a cliff. And I think we've always wondered, oh, this will go off a cliff. It's never going to be off a cliff. It's going to have to be slow erosion, and everybody's just going to have patience. But I do think there is slow erosion, and there's more evidence of erosion than there is of gaining. Put it that way.
But when you look toward 2022, which many people are thinking about, though, what does that mean in terms of those elections? That maybe the right. Trump's candidate will be the nominee of the Republican Party in the congressional race or whatever race it is, but that that Trumpster can't win the district or the state?
I think that's going to be the referendum. I think that whether, you know, Republicans were hoping to make 22 a referendum on Biden. Obviously, right? Who, you know, and I think that with Trump so involved, it means there's going to be two referendums.
Yeah.
Right. And it's going to be what's more powerful. You know, will it be if for some reason there's frustration with Biden or in some form among independents, right? You know, we don't know this, right? I don't think any of us know for sure what the political environment's going to look like. I think you have sort of a mechanical advantage that the Republicans have just because they control the remapping process. But, you know, at the same time, the Democrats have the better map to compete with on the Senate side.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll give you a result. What happens if the Republicans win the House but Democrats hold the Senate? What would be the declaration of who won the midterms?
I don't know. What would it be?
Well, I can tell you. Right. The answer
I
is,
Go
ahead.
Nobody. No, I think it just means status, a little more, you know, somewhat.
It means that nothing ever happens.
Scenario, it means it's a it means it's somewhat of a status quo election, other than now Republicans have subpoena power and they're going to make Biden's life miserable for a year.
Yeah, but I guess it would mean the Senate would be there with the judges, though, which is
right.
And Democrats.
That's a good point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and maybe
so it would be a wash. I think it would be sort of it would be something everybody would have something to hang their hat on. And right now, I actually think that's the most likely scenario. Just went by the math, I'd rather be the Democrats in the Senate and Republicans with the House.
You know, I was going to say I don't want to belabor the point, but I do want to belabor the point. Do you ever have time in your life, because I don't know if we do, to step back for a second and say we appear to be on a path where a month or two or five from now, a former president of the United States is going to be criminally indicted and possibly go to jail? I mean,
do you really think that's going
to
happen?
I don't think he goes to jail.
I think he may not even get indicted.
You know. Trump always wriggles out of these things. He always wriggles out.
Yeah.
And somebody else usually takes the fall for him.
Yep.
Right? I mean, think about it. Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort served time in prison. Did Donald Trump?
Nope.
Right?
You think he's going to offer up Melania or what, Chuck? Is that what he's going to do?
It all will depend. I'm going to go back to something I mentioned earlier. He chose not to sever his official ties with his business, mm-hmm. right? Which makes him now perhaps responsible. But we don't know if suddenly it is Eric and I think he's capable of throwing his sons under the bus.
Absolutely. Are you kidding? In a nanosecond.
But not his daughter.
I think he'd throw her too.
But not. I think. Well, I've always said we'll know when the Trump name is truly impossible to defend. When she starts going by Kushner. You know, have you noticed what Melinda Gates is doing right now?
She's yes.
Yes, French Melinda Gates. French
right?
Gates.
Yes.
French Gates, right? So it will be, you'll watch this. So right now it's still Ivanka, but it will start with Trump Kushner. When she starts going by Trump Kushner, then you'll know.
We'll be watching.
She's laying the groundwork.
Hey, Chuck.
Chuck, we love having you first, but it also ruins my whole day, you know, in some ways. It's just.
Do I really?
Well,
I
know. We love it, and, well, I don't know.
You feed, well, by the way, we feed each other then.
Oh, yes, we do.
My housemate here, my spouse, loves to hear me do this. And she goes, wow, you guys really get into it. It's so demoralizing. Yeah, I know.
I said, but we
sort of have this dark comedic side to this, which is what I enjoy about talking with you guys, because it's dark.
It's dark.
But you see the light. Yeah.
Or
the freight train coming at us. I don't know.
Oh, exactly.
Well, it's a light or a freight train.
Exactly. Chuck, it's been a pleasure,
hey,
as always.
Say hello to your wife
for
us. I think she's got great taste.
I will.
See you.
Okay.
All right,
Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Dark and comedic. That's what I love, Jim. Okay. Coming up, we're opening up the lines and taking your calls. Asking you about the state reopening this weekend.
Oh, this is upbeat. Okay, yeah, it is.
It is upbeat.
Yeah.
It is up. Well, I think it is. Are you ready to plunge into a post-pandemic world? Keep it on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browning and Marjorie. For 17 years, cicadas do very little. They hang out in the ground. They suck, I don't know, sugar out of tree roots. Then following an absurdly long hibernation, they sprout wings, make a ton of noise, and, as we discussed the other day with Simon Montgomery, go wild. Well, this spring's cicada breakout parallels our own. As you know, for Massachusetts, this Saturday is our breakout moment as virtually all COVID-19 restrictions come to an end. All industry restrictions will be lifted. Capacity will be back to 100%. And fully vaccinated people will be able to go mask-free indoors, except on public and private transportation. Non-vaccinated people will still be advised to wear face masks and socially distance in most situations. So we're taking your calls asking you, are you ready? 877-301-8970. After a year of living in isolation, are you prepared for this emotionally, financially? Did you forget how much it costs to go to a movie or buy a round of drinks? And like the cicadas, have you been bursting at the seams waiting to get back to normal after a year of using the pandemic to get out of social invitations? And no one does that better than me. What excuse do you have now? 877-301-8970. Can I tell you something? I've been already doing a lot of stuff. I was out to dinner last night with a good friend of both of ours. And so I've been getting
outside
there.
Outside or inside?
Outside. And it was okay. Literally we were done just as the rain started exploding with the lightning.
Would you have
and the
gone
sky
inside?
Was
real.
What?
Would you have gone inside?
Who cares?
Well,
I would have gone inside. Yeah, I would have gone inside.
Okay,
fine. Thank you. What did you have for dinner, Jim? Well, it's not a, okay.
Because outside versus inside has been a big deal, Jim.
Outside
that is why
is
I asked.
Everything.
Okay.
Everything.
But people have avoided inside because of the pandemic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I missed that point. Now I apologize.
It's a
okay.
Good point there, Jim.
Thank you. It was an excellent point. Now, having said that, this to me, even though I have been doing a lot of things since I was fully vaccinated, it was like a month or 2 months ago or something.
The end of March, I think,
okay.
Both of us.
But beyond that, I feel like it's the countdown to the ball in Times Square. 12, I'm serious. 12, I'm listening to the radio this morning, and there's a story about how Encore, you know, the casino in Everett? Yeah, in Everett.
Yep.
Is going to open at 12:01, or not open. I mean, open according to all the new, you can be fully open at 12:01. And I got all excited. I have no intention of going to Encore. Just the fact that it was, you know, do you know what I mean by
Absolutely.
That? It's like thrilling all this.
And you'll go down, it'll be back to normal. You go down the streets in the Back Bay, it'll be full of traffic and no place to park. You try to get out of Boston, it'll be full of traffic and no place to get off the side of the road and all that kind of stuff. But I'm very excited. I am excited
what
about
are you,
it.
Excuse me. What are you doing this exciting
breakout
moment?
You, it's not exactly a breakout
what
moment.
What is
it? I told you. Well, we're friendly with Tom Rush.
We
the
love
great,
Tom
folk
Rush.
Singer. We call him a folk singer, don't we?
He's a legendary and great and a legendarily wonderful human being,
and,
too.
And with some friends from my hometown, which is Fall River, I'm going to go see him at the Narrows.
How great is that?
I'm very excited.
Well, that's
about
a big deal. It's an indoor concert,
it's an indoor
and I assume
concert.
At 100% capacity.
I don't know, but I'll find out. I'm very excited about seeing him. And
you know,
he was
my idol in college, as I've told you
oh my
before.
Gosh.
I mean, literally my idol.
He's great, and
love
he's
him.
He's still great, actually, which is very encouraging to us all. But the other thing I was going to say is, you know what's happened to? I've gotten invited places.
Oh,
mostly
excuse me.
Because I'm on the radio. It's not that they're that interested in me. But I am on the radio. You have to keep that in mind. You know, it's not you, Marjorie. It's
I don't
that you are on the
mind.
Radio. So I'm suddenly more popular than I was, just 3 months ago.
You was
been invited to things and weddings. You know, my daughter got married in a
teeny tiny wedding. We've heard
teeny
this
tiny kind of wedding, and I felt
which sounded great to me.
It was nice, but it would have been nicer for her if more of her friends had been able to come, and they weren't able
have
to
a
come.
Party.
So I'm very happy for all the people now that can finally have weddings, as Rune Rolf was saying in the newscast and for the newscast, and can have a dance floor.
One last thing for the calls, 877-301-8970. You always really excited. I'd met our friend last night for dinner between Newbury and Boylston. And to get looking for a parking space, I'm driving down Newbury on the hottest night of the year. And I assume regular listeners know if it was 90 degrees every day, I'd be happy. So it was the hottest night of the year, a beautiful night until the rain exploded. Even the rain was beautiful. And I drive down Newbury Street, not one seat at an outside restaurant or bar was empty. And you know how great it was? I mean, it was like everything was coming to life. And we're not insensitive, even though we sound insensitive. But people still suffering. We know they are. But for people who have been chomping at the bit, Governor Baker's announcement that May 29th is the coming out date is huge.
And you know what else you've noticed? If you've been trying to get some restaurant reservations, which
impossible.
I've been trying to get
impossible.
For some people. Impossible.
It is.
I was trying to get one a month ahead. And it was difficult to get.
Do you know, but can I tell you what is really useful is when you call and say, I have no reservation, you say, do you know who I am? Now, the only problem with that is more often than not, they say, no, actually, I don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Which is it's a bit of a downer, I'd say. Well, are you sure you don't? Paul from Worcester, you're first on Boston Public Radio, 2 days ahead of the reopening of Massachusetts. Hey, Paul.
Thank you, Marjorie and Jim. How are you guys today?
We're good. Good
to
hear from you.
Thanks for calling, Paul.
Hey, I'm a little concerned. I think it's going to be like amateur night all weekend.
Could be.
I've heard a few people say, I'm not wearing a mask, no matter what the sign on the store says or the bar says or whatever, and you can't make me because the rules say I don't have to. Even though when the rules said they did have to, they didn't wear a mask. You see how the rules work two ways for them.
Well, but private businesses can still set their own standards. But I understand what you're saying. There is potential for there to be like an explosion because people have felt so cooped up. But this has been a pretty responsible state, Paul, for them. And so is Rhode Island and New Hampshire. I mean, people have played by the rules. They've gotten vaccinated in numbers higher than anywhere else in the country, New England I'm talking about. So I'm pretty confident that with some outliers, it's going to be okay. Are you doing something special?
No, I'm not a fan of all the crowds, so Pepper the Wonder Dog and I are going to grill up some ribs, and maybe I'll see my neighbors. But yeah, I usually leave the country when there's something going on. I was in Australia, New Zealand when the marathon bombing happened. I woke up, I turn on the TV, I see the BBC news, and it happened like 15 minutes. They say breaking news from Boston, saying I'm halfway around the planet, I can't get away from Boston. On the 4th of July marathon, so I try and stay away from this stuff.
So say woof to Pepper for us,
Pepper
Paul.
The
thank
dog.
You. We appreciate
Happy
your call,
Memorial
Paul.
Memorial Day to Pepper. Hope the fireworks aren't going to start in earnest Memorial Day. They did last summer. Hope they don't for all the dogs that are driven crazy by it. Here's what Tom says from New Hampshire. He says, my mask is my binky. I've been living in fear for years, so even though I'm fully vaccinated, I still won't go indoors without my mask, my binky. Hard to let go of the fear.
So I don't know what the rules are at whatever the venue you're going to Saturday night to see Tom Rush. If they let's assume they don't say that a mask is not mandated. Will you wear one inside?
Well, I'll do the same thing I've done in restaurants.
Which is
wear one when I'm walking around and take it.
How about when you're
table?
Sitting in your seat, when there's somebody close to you on your left and right and in front of you and behind you?
I think we have tables.
Oh, it's that kind of setting?
I hope so.
So you'll be with your friends.
Yes. Setting.
Okay, fine. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Cambridge. And Joan. Welcome, Joan. Hi.
Oh.
Hi.
So I'm also very unhappy.
Why?
I realized, first of all, during COVID, excuse me, that I'm much more of an introvert than I thought. And now I there's too many expectations. From friends and family who are calling to get together. And I just want to stay home. And I agree with Tom. My mask is my binky, too. And during COVID, I feel like I stripped down to all just the necessities of what I needed to do. And now there's just too much going on. I'm very nervous.
You know, I have a couple of friends who are like you, Joan, that they have really enjoyed the simplicity of their lives, not having to go to this, that, and the other thing, not having to show up every day at work all dressed up, not having to put their mascara on and their lipstick on, et cetera. I don't think you're unusual. I mean, do you have buddies that feel the same way you do, too?
No. They all are calling me to get together.
Yeah.
Well, Joan, you know what? I'm not a shrink, as Marjorie would say. I'm not an expert on ease back in, I think. I mean, what we're describing is I think there's going to be an explosion of activity, which I understand is intimidating to some people. So ease back in ways that you're comfortable. And I think once you get your foot in, you're going to feel, I think, a little bit better when the sun's out and you see people smiling and you can actually see the lower half of their face. So give it a try and let us know how it goes. Joan, good luck. 877-301-8970.
Did you announce what you were doing to celebrate this weekend?
No, I did not.
Oh, you would just like to share that with people since I shared what I was doing?
Oh, no, I would not, actually. Thank you for asking. No, I would not.
You know, it's terrible. It's going to rain all weekend.
The weather's going to be, don't do this. I mean, the weather's going to be horrible, but that's not even, actually, it is unfortunate. You also realize, I know this is no great revelation, when restaurants are right at the top of the list of small businesses that have suffered the worst through this thing, you finally open the damn state. And I'm not criticizing Governor Baker for this at all. I mean, it's great that he moved his August 1st date up to May 29th. But wouldn't you wish that the first holiday weekend where everything is open, that the weather was great so yes. people could patronize. I mean, yes. you can still go inside, and I'm sure there'll be some times a day when you can
eat
outside.
Can barbecue without yeah. an umbrella.
But I'm talking about patronizing these restaurants, you know, which really need the business. In any case, 877-301-8970. One of the big fights, by the way, speaking of patronizing restaurants, I had a little debate on my television show the other night, is whether the legislature is going to decide to extend what Governor Baker had unilaterally put in place, which is what we talked about, takeout cocktails, which are a huge thing. Obviously, the package stores are opposing it. And on this issue, respectfully to the package store owners, I hope the restaurants win.
Me too. Lisa in the car, thank you for calling.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Joan Madry. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you for calling.
My story, and my son, who is only 15, he's had his first dose of the vaccine only, scheduled in next week or so to get his second. And he was invited to the Red Sox game on Saturday. And he's a huge Red Sox fan, baseball player himself. And unfortunately, I had to say no. He could not go because Saturday is the first day that Fenway is at full capacity. And masks are required for unvaccinated people only. And he has no problem wearing a mask, but quite frankly, I don't trust people to wear their masks if they're unvaccinated. And I just feel like he's still too much at risk to be with 38,000 other people in Fenway Park.
So can I tell you something?
A little bit disappointing.
If I had a teenage kid now, and mine are in their late 20s, I have to say I'm looking at Marjorie because I probably would do what Lisa's doing. I know it's going to disappoint your son. But hopefully he'll get an invitation. What, he only has to wait a couple of weeks after that. Would you not do the same thing Lisa's doing, Marjorie, or you wouldn't?
Well,
I know it's outdoors.
You know, Lisa, isn't there a pretty good, after your first dose, aren't you in pretty good shape protection-wise? I thought you were.
Well, they say 80%, but as opposed to 90-some percent.
Yeah.
But you're still not fully vaccinated, which is the ultimate.
How crushed is your boy, Lisa?
He's pretty disappointed, I have to say. It's one of his very best friends that asked him to go, and he's quite disappointed. But honestly, both my kids have both taken this whole year and a half with, in stride and taken it really well. So I give them a lot of credit. I just feel like it's one more disappointment that they have to suffer through. I have my older son is a 2020 high school graduate, so he missed out on everything.
Oh yeah, that's so tough.
I feel like it's just one disappointment after another for my kids, but I feel like maybe in the end they'll be stronger, a little bit more resilient, and they're showing their tenacity. So I'm proud of them, but yes, it is disappointing for sure for him.
I would buy him a ticket for maybe 3 weeks hence if I were you, Lisa. Thank you.
I think it's good for some big bucks, Lisa. Get him behind the dugout or something. Of course, you made a couple of grand. How much does it cost to get tickets? Really,
I don't know what. I don't know what the tickets are.
They're probably expensive, but that's tough. That is tough. And her son, the one she mentioned, Lisa. Thank you very much for the call. The one that graduated last year. Boy, for those kids, I felt so bad.
Horrible.
Not only because of them missing the graduation, those last few months of high school, which were such fun, the highlights for many of us, then to not have to either stay home from college or not even be able to get a job because of COVID.
Or go to college and not meet any of your classmates or your teachers it was really tough. I mean, you know what's also horrible about Lisa's story? I don't want to belabor it, but, it's the first day, too. So I'm sure the kid in some ways was saying, finally able to go do what I love, watch the Red Sox. I have to say, on my list of things that I am dying to do is Fenway, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the notion of being in a packed stadium, fully vaccinated.
Those sausages.
On a sunny day with 5 or 6 sausages is really – can we just say this, by the way, before we take a break? And I'm not exaggerating. I could eat – I could eat 6 of those sausages.
I bet you could.
Load them up with the grilled peppers and the grilled onion, I know that's not your kind of thing. Not right.
It doesn't get much better than that.
I'll tell you, I could do it in a. You know, we did a show
get
a couple
right where you want them.
Many years ago. I think we did it on commercial radio. You know that site that has all the world record eating contest, sort of like the Coney Island hot dog thing.
Boston on 4th of July.
How disgusting are they?
Oh, my God. And 4th of July would be like 95 degrees, and they're shoving these hot dogs down their mouths.
But this website is not just hot dogs. It's oysters, spam, you know, whatever it is.
Pies.
Pies, exactly.
I mean, it is the grossest thing going. And but I don't know if they'll be doing it this year in East Boston, but they did for years.
If you want to Google it, it's something competitive eating. I can't remember what the acronym is, but it's something something CE. We should take
maybe
a break.
Crazy Legs Conti. He was one of the big
stars.
He's
a local, isn't he?
And there was a woman that weighed about 75 pounds.
The Black Widow or something? We interviewed one of them.
Asian woman.
Yeah.
Teeny tiny, little bit of a thing. And she could, I don't know how many hot dogs she could eat and pies she could wolf down, but it was a lot.
Then when it comes to sausages at Fenway, I could enter. I could enter and win.
We're talking about the return to pre-pandemic living, taking your calls on what lifting restrictions on Massachusetts means for you. The conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marge Regan and Jim Brown. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Saturday and what the end of COVID restrictions in Massachusetts mean for you. Do you have plans? Are you nervous, like some of our callers have suggested? Are you ready for pre-pandemic living? Will you miss a year of living simply and frugally? I mean, it has, you know, because you couldn't do much, a lot of people have, especially middle and upper income people, have saved a decent amount of money. That's obviously going to come to an end. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Brookline, where Shane is calling. Hey, Shane.
Hello.
Hello to you.
Taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I'm a musician, and I can't wait to get back to work. Basically, I'm lucky that I have my own teaching business, but my income was cut in half because no live gigs for over a year. So I just can't wait to get back to work because not only is it for financial reasons, but it's my way of life.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's very depressing when your way of life gets cut off.
When's your first, do you have a date yet? Do you have your first date?
Yeah, Tuesday, June 1st. I'm actually playing in Concord, New Hampshire. So
where are you playing?
You guys,
are you in a group or are you in a band or are you you?
I'm me. It's the Shane Alessio Band.
Shane Alessio Band.
Nice.
Where are you playing on June 1st? We'll give it a little pump here, Shane.
It's Hermanos in Concord, New Hampshire.
Great. And how psyched are you?
I'm super psyched. And I'm playing some of my original music, and I can't wait to get out there. I'm rehearsing on Friday tomorrow. I'm just like, you know, jumping around, just all excited.
Well, we wish you luck. I mean, you can hear it in your voice. I think it's great. And good luck in Concord, and people should go. Shane, good luck, and let us know how it goes. 877-301-8970. Live music. But, well, you're doing live music,
I
obviously.
Am. Yeah.
What a great start. That is a great choice, by the way.
I know. Really I'm anxious to see how it's going to be arranged. Are people just going to be – it's done? We're just going to be, you know, all bets are off? Or is it going to be, like what Shane was saying, where he goes, is it going to be a little bit more constrained where people are sitting further away from the band? Or I don't know.
I don't know. Don't you think it's going to be a case-by-case kind of
– Yeah, and I think – I mean, we're getting a lot of emails from people that are still very nervous about this, and they're still
Nervous about certain indoor things.
You know, apparently, a lot of our listeners are calling their mask their binky, and they're a little concerned about going binky-less, Jim.
Well, like, pick an example where I know I'm nervous, not about to do it. And again, I don't want to hurt anybody's business. Mm-hmm. Would you go to a packed large movie theater, like a Lowe's whatever, with 800 people in it or 1,000 people?
No. I wouldn't. But you know what I am doing today for the first time since this whole thing began?
I can't wait.
Getting my toenails painted.
You are?
I'm getting a pedicure.
Really?
Yes, I am.
Where and when? I think people are going to – no, I'm serious. I think people are going to want to go and be part of this moment.
In.
So wait a second. You haven't done that for a year and a half because you were nervous about –
I have not done it for a year and a half.
Wow.
I did it myself, and let me tell you, it was a sad situation.
Where do you want to go?
Donna in Providence. Hi,
Donna. Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
We're great.
Hi, thanks.
I, transparency, I actually live in North Providence.
Mm-hmm.
North Smithfield, but mm-hmm. I say Providence because my friends and family from Albany don't know where North Providence and North Smithfield is.
That's okay, Donna.
Anyway, the story is that I'm one of those breakthrough COVID cases.
Do you want to explain what that is to people?
Oh, okay. Well, I am fully vaccinated, and I work at a skilled nursing facility in Cumberland, and we are tested every Wednesday, and I have always been tested and came out negative. And two Wednesdays ago, I had a positive test, and they called me from the health department, and no, it was last Wednesday, and they called me from the health department and said to quarantine for 10 days. If I still have symptoms, 10 more. The symptoms, unfortunately, that I had, I thought were allergies, until they called me from the health department, and the woman told me, absolutely, they are not. They're COVID symptoms. So here I am.
How you taking this? Quarantine. How you taking? I mean, we discussed breakthroughs with Art Kaplan a day, or it was yesterday or the day before. They're very few in number, but obviously for you,
so how sick,
the numbers don't matter.
Yeah, how sick are you feeling, Donna? Is it like an allergy thing, or is it like you feel like you're feeling horrible?
It's like an allergy thing and a flu.
A flu.
But poor I don't you. Have a fever. I don't have a fever.
So it's manageable. It's manageable. It's not like you're...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well,
but
that's
you can't
good.
Go out. By the way, opening day in Rhode Island is tomorrow, right? Friday, I think, is Rhode Island.
Yeah, right.
Saturday
well,
is us.
I won't be opening.
No, I know.
And when we do, I really do plan to wear my mask. Not obsessively so. I get, like, if I'm walking with friends outside, I probably won't, but... No, I mean, I know I won't, but in a restaurant, if I go shopping in a store.
Well, especially
again.
In light of your breakthrough experience. You know, Donna, we wish you a speedy recovery, and you have a pretty good spirit considering you're vaccinated and had to deal with it. We wish you a lot of luck.
Yeah,
we'll be thinking
you.
Of you. Donna, thanks
thank
for
you
the
very much
for
the call.
Yeah,
that was sort of frightening yesterday when there were people that we're getting the breakthrough, but they're few and far between.
Not only few, but they're generally, as you asked, they're very minor symptoms. The vast majority of those very, very few people are not being hospitalized and dying. And there are very few examples.
David on the road. What's up with you, David?
Hi, David.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have worked in Boston as a queer nightlife performer for a few years across a bunch of different bars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited to go back. I thought the community came together really well and did some awesome virtual shows and performances and gigs. But there's nothing quite like an in-person drag queen where you might get a little wet, you might get some glitter on you. So I'm looking forward to getting my friends working again and being out.
When's that happening? Do you know?
My friend's first show is, I believe, Saturday night. They're hosting something at Legacy.
Isn't
which
it incredible?
Is right downtown.
I mean, that's an example. I mean, everybody counting down to that moment. And I think that's great. And we can hear it in your voice, too, David. Enjoy and thanks so much for the call. I mean, people, as you can tell, these are obviously we talked to a couple of people in the performing world. I mean,
who've gotten so screwed. How about the
screwed?
Boston Pops running around giving these concerts outside? And we were over at the Jamaica Pond giving an outdoor concert, and thanks to people that supported them.
But can I tell you, I've watched some of the virtual stuff that both the Pops and BSO has done. I didn't think, I mean, I have to be honest, I didn't think I'd like it because being in the hall is so incredibly great. They've been great. I mean, they really have brilliantly, both Andres Nelson's and Keith Lockhart and their colleagues have, I think, brilliantly converted to another medium.
When you go see these people perform, you realize it's like we've got the NBA of musicians. I mean, the people that get hired by the BSO or the Boston Pops are so talented. It just kind of knocks your socks off. Caroline from Melrose, thank you for calling.
Hey, Caroline.
Hi.
Hi.
So, a little bit of a twist on this.
What's that?
I am going to my nephew's wedding June 4th, and it's in Ohio. And I am really terrified of the reception. It's like I'm especially terrified because I think my nephew is marrying into an anti-vaxxer family.
Oh, gosh.
And so, you know, the wedding ceremony itself, no problem. You can sit in a church, wear your mask, et cetera, et cetera. But you get to the reception and all my family will be there, and my family is all vaccinated. But what about her family? And then the introductions, and do I put my mask up when I talk to them, but I take my mask down when I talk to my parents? And
Caroline, is it too late for somebody to back out of this,
yeah,
or what?
Yeah, back out.
I don't mean you. I mean marrying it. Boy, you know, we talked a lot through the last 4 years of these strange couplings of pro and anti-Trump families, husbands, wives, partners, spouses, whatever. I haven't thought a lot about this at all. Is a coming together of families, one of which is anti-vax. Boy, that I wish I could tell you I'd feel more comfortable than you, but I would share your anxiety. We wish you luck too, Caroline. Boy, what about that? What about at your teeny tiny wedding of your daughter? I know you love this kid. If your daughter had married into an anti-vax family,
Are you kidding? Everybody had to have 19 tests they showed up at the wedding. Everybody, you know, is masked.
But that's a tough one. As I was saying to her, we really haven't talked about this at all.
You know,
I never even thought about it.
I wouldn't let him come. I mean, that would be very easy for me. You can't come.
The other half of the marriage?
That was the deal. You couldn't. Well,
I'm not talking about the family. How about the person you're marrying?
I cannot imagine any one of my children marrying an anti-vaxxer. I just don't think it could. No, I don't think so. I mean, I hope I wouldn't raise kids that are as selfish as that.
Ooh, them's tough words.
Well,
there.
Unless, again, the caveat, you got
no, we're not talking about autoimmune.
But otherwise, you just are a selfish person. Cindy from Rockport, thank you for calling.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
I, too, am looking forward to seeing Tom Rush, hopefully, in Rockport sometime in the next
what's
few
the
months.
Name, Cindy, what's the name of that fabulous, fabulous venue in Rockport? What's it called?
I'm never sure of pronouncing it. The Shaylin Lou?
Everybody said it's the and the whole back of the place is open, from what I understand. It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, that's right here.
The whole back is all open glass out to the ocean. It's the most beautiful setting.
So
it's
I hear.
Gorgeous.
He plays there all the time, yeah. So what's up with
he
you?
Does. I was hoping you'd remind some folks. We know a lot of people going maskless haven't been vaccinated, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They're probably the ones who are most angry if they see a shop or an ice cream shop that says mask, please.
I'm sure.
I just hope that people could be reminded. There are a lot of young teens who are working these jobs, and they are not yet fully vaccinated.
Yeah.
And before people have a tantrum of why should I, you know, it says the state you don't need a mask. When shops, ice cream shops, gift shops do have a sign, to keep that in mind, that it could be their son or daughter who's 14, 15, 16 serving them, and they are not protected.
I'm so glad you called.
Some of that word.
Well, we didn't get the word out, but you just did. And we were amiss. I'm really glad you called, Cindy. Thank you. And I hope you get to see Tom soon.
I did notice, I was just at an ice cream shop 2 weeks ago, and a family came, and the guy poked his head right in the ice cream slider window that clearly had a sign, mask must be worn, to the teenager, poked his head in and said, do I really need a mask? And she said, yes. So I can see that coming. And please, I hope the right people have heard this.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that could be your son or daughter, the teen working behind that counter that's helping you.
Cindy, and also don't put them in the position where they have to be the mask police. Cindy, great call. Thank you for making it.
You know, we just got an email from Amanda who was pointing out that Lisa called earlier about her son going to Fenway Park.
Yeah.
She wasn't going to let him
go.
Amanda points out that there have been almost zero cases of spread outdoors.
Yeah.
And that's a good point. So she's telling Lisa, you should let the sun go. I mean, it's obviously up to Lisa, but that is a good point.
But you're packed in pretty. Lisa, what's the emailer's name? I'm sorry.
Amanda.
Amanda's totally right, but you're pretty, it's almost sardine-like in most seats.
Yes.
At Fenway, as fabulous as Fenway is. Not all. They've really done
a
wonderful revamp
now,
of the place.
Jim, as we know.
Well, obviously, as we know,
stuck.
The seat you and I
and
sat in a couple of years ago were not enlarged. It's amazing. I actually had gotten out of the seat by now, much less on the day.
It would be awful. Who could take you seriously with a chair stuck to your butt, Jim?
It was literally. If the chair been removable, as Marjorie says, I'd still be walking around. In the Fenway seat. That's how narrow this particular one was. But they've made great strides.
Gene for Jamaica Plain, thank you for calling.
Hey, Gene.
Yes, I am calling in defense of all the children who are still in masks.
Yeah.
it just feels cruel that everybody keeps saying no restrictions, no restrictions. And if you are 12 or under, you have no choice. And you spend the entire day in a mask. And I mean, I'm celebrating that all of the elders, you know, like my husband was in an assisted living and I didn't get to see him in person for months. And it, you know, I'm really thrilled that there are so many people able to connect with each other again now, grandparents and grandchildren. Yeah. But I feel so bad for the under 12s.
Yeah, but it's only going to I hear that it's going to be a finite period of time. If you listen to Dr. Fauci, well, we just got, you know, 12 to 15 emergency use authorization for Pfizer. Moderna said a day or two ago, 100% effective in that age group. Fauci says the next age group down, I think it's 6 to 11, if I'm correct, he thinks could be a month or so away. So I know it's hard to wait.
Well, it's
but
hard.
We're close,
but
Jean.
The person we talked about yesterday that got the breakthrough COVID that had been fully vaccinated, got it from her son, who took off his mask at a basketball game, and then everybody got sick. So, I mean, it is awful, but you're right. It's not that much longer, we hope. Okay, we have time for a quick one.
30
Claire
seconds, Claire. Really
quick.
Short on
Thank
time.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
So I'm renovating a house in Worcester, and I've been interviewing plumbers, electricians, plasterers. I interviewed probably 10 plumbers, 15 plumbers, because I have to get the best price. Out of all of them, I probably interviewed 25 or 30 people. Two of them said they're going to get the vaccine or they have the vaccine. All of them said, oh, no, I had COVID. I don't need the vaccine. Oh, it's ridiculous. But I will tell you, anybody who's over 50, the two that said they got it were over 50. They're all 30, 40.
Yeah.
It's just frightening. And I'm at a point where I'm saying, do I hire these guys? Do I tell them no, they have to get vaccinated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or either tell them to get vaccinated, Claire, or you buy a new house. That's my advice. Claire, thank you for the call. You know, I'm with you, but people know that. I just cannot believe that there, if you are not medically compromised, it's just, it's insane. The people are not, you don't have to wait anymore. You don't have to go to a central registration system. Go to your pharmacy.
Things to discover that so many of our fellow Americans are that selfish, that they get into fights with airline attendants about wearing a mask on a plane.
Flight attendant got punched in the face.
Yeah, that's right. She got punched in the face. Didn't she bite her too or some crazy thing like that? Anyway, coming up, this week's edition of Law and Order, former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety Andrew Cabral is going to be next. We're going to talk to her about Boston Police and a bunch of other stuff. Next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, connecting Mayor Kim Janey, fire commissioner for a day, Dennis White, or not. On Tuesday, a judge ruled that Janey could. Then in less than 24 hours, that same judge granted a stay that puts Janey's plans to fire White on hold. So what exactly is behind the judge's thinking? Andrew Cabral joins us to make sense of White's legal saga. Then the Globe's Shirley Leung joins us for her take on corporate America. A year after George Floyd's murder, has big business made good on its pledge to boost racial equity?
Rick Steves is known for his guidebooks about European travel. His business is exclusively dedicated to European tours. His TV show is titled Rick Steves Europe. Turns out, India is his favorite country. He joins us to talk about why it's the country that's captured his heart and soul and how he's thinking about India today now that it's being subsumed by the coronavirus. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. And you're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. Joining us on the line for this week's edition of Law and Order is former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety, and current CEO of Ascend. Hello, Andrew Cabral.
Hello. How are you? Have you guys gone to the store?
I have driven by the store, by the way. When you were closed the other night, I was in the North End, and the location is great. And as I don't want to get into this, but since you asked, I forwarded to Andrea a few friends of mine, communication who had been there, who were raving about the retail location. So you happy now or no?
I am very happy, and thank you for being my message middleman.
That's why I'm here.
It's Memorial Day weekend. This could be a big weekend, Andrew Cabral, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So anyway, we were just talking to Chuck Todd before about the Manhattan District Attorney convening this special grand jury to look into whether they should indict former President Trump and for misdeeds, alleged misdeeds, I should say, with his real estate portfolio and stuff like that. Without getting too much into the weeds of the legal details, Chuck mentioned that the president, former president, has managed to weasel out of everything he's gotten himself into so far. From what you know to date, is this something he can weasel out of too?
I don't think so. I do think that, you know, the fact that they've impaneled them for 6 months, you know, was considered to be sort of an extended grand jury, is indicative of the complexity of the case. But to Chuck Todd's point, part of the reason that the case is so complex is because he's been getting away with this and perfecting it over a period of 30 years. So if he had been stopped much, much earlier, it would be a very, very different thing. But they're now looking at, you know, 30 years of what is essentially an ongoing, in my view, criminal enterprise that has used the law or twisted it. And I think that makes it more challenging. But I don't think I can't see right now a way that he walks away from this.
You know, one of the tiredest lines is, you know, a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich, meaning that if a prosecutor convenes a grand jury, that if they want that grand jury to indict, they do. Obviously, people know you're a former prosecutor. This is not your typical case. There's never been one like it in the history of the United States of America. Having said that, how often is it that a prosecutor convenes a grand jury and does not get a desired indictment?
It does happen. It doesn't happen frequently, but it does happen. I think that given the fact that this has never happened with a former president before, I think Cyrus Vance's office, you know, understands sort of the historical nature of it, mm-hmm. but also the complexity of it. You absolutely want to be clear as you're presenting this case that you're presenting it in a way that makes sense to the grand jurors. And keep in mind, you know, grand jurors get to ask questions. They get to subpoena mm-hmm. documents. It's really a very unique role in criminal jurisprudence to be a grand juror, and they can take it in directions that, you know, you might not have thought of. So this is going to be a very, very interesting, very engaged, I think, process for these grand jurors.
One last question about this. The conventional wisdom, which I think is virtually unanimous wisdom, is since Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan DA, who's now working with the Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, but since Vance is not running for re-election, and I think his term expires at the end of the year, I'm not sure, but it's close to the end of the year, that he wants this done and an indictment or a non-indictment, whatever, a conclusion of this process before, that makes total sense to me. If it isn't concluded and the grand jury is still deliberating and a new district attorney comes in, does the whole process, in a de facto way, I know legally it doesn't, there's still, well, I don't know legally, does the whole process have to start all over again?
It doesn't. No. I mean, if you need more time, you can always seek to extend the grand jury. From what I understand, the folks that are running to or considering running to replace Cyrus Vance have already made this particular
yes.
case a center point or a highlight of their campaign messaging. It may be moot because, you know, if Vance gets his way, it may all be done. But also keep in mind that, you know, we sort of focus on potential indictments against Donald Trump, which I assume are going to be forthcoming. But given the depth and the breadth of this, it's about the Trump organization as well, especially mm-hmm. having now merged with Letitia James's investigation.
Right.
And don't be surprised if Donald Trump isn't the only person indicted. It could be his kids, other members of the Trump organization, people connected to Weisselberg, if Weisselberg doesn't get, you know, immunity to
testify. His chief financial guy, for those who don't know, yeah, who's been with
yeah.
him
I mean,
for
it
decades.
Could be a lot more, yeah, than just Donald Trump in terms of the indictments that they will consider. I think at a minimum, Vance wants the indictments, even if the grand jury continues its business with regard to potential charges against others, Vance wants the Trump indictments, if they're going to be forthcoming in the can by the end of the year.
We're talking with Andrew Cabral for another edition of Law & Order. So, Andrew, let's get back to the Boston police morass. As people probably know by now, one day after this judge, the Superior Court, Heidi Breiger, said that the acting mayor of Boston, Kim Janey, could fire the Boston Police Commissioner for a day, she reversed herself and delayed the ruling affecting the ability for Janey to fire while White and his attorneys appeal her decision. You know, the Globe had this editorial the other day talking about how Boston is unusual. Other places, you can apparently, the mayor can fire the police commissioner, but we seem to have this unusual old law that makes it more difficult. So what do you make of this?
Well, I don't think that the judge, you know, strictly sort of, I don't think she gave permission for the acting mayor to fire him. She denied the injunction, which was the thing that was standing in the way. And yes, there's a removal provision, you know, in the Mass General laws that talks about removal for cause and a hearing. And I think I may be wrong about this. I don't think I am. I think that there is an actual agreement or a contract that the commissioner signs, because I think it is for a period of 5 years. I think that's internal. I think that's, you know, extraneous to any statute. So my questions have always been about if there is some sort of agreement or something that the commissioner signs that the city is a part of, what are the provisions in that with regard to behavior and removal? But the removal provision, you know, does talk about a certain amount of due process and removal for cause. So what you have here is essentially the judge denying the request for a temporary injunction, saying that she did not believe that Dennis White would prevail on the merits. And it's really about him, her belief that the forum, you know, he's not entitled to a hearing before the court on his removal. That's not the process that is outlined in the removal petition.
Yeah, I don't want to get lost in the weeds on this one either. Unless I misunderstood you, Marjorie, I don't think there's a question as to whether or not a mayor can fire a police commissioner for cause. My understanding is his lawyer is arguing that he didn't get due process under whatever the law or contract is. There was not a hearing, et cetera, et cetera. But rather than getting, I mean, we know what the status quo is, that Dennis White can't be fired as long as there's this stay in effect, as Marjorie said, during his appeal of the judge's ruling. As someone who was in law enforcement for so much of your career, there's a very low-profile guy, as I've said many a time on the air here, I had a dealing with him about something totally unrelated that was actually very well handled, Greg Long, acting commissioner, who's really been under the radar. He hasn't done anything publicly. Can a police operation in a major American city do its job well with all of this chaos, lingering chaos at the top, or does it trickle down into the operation, Andrew Cabral?
Well, I think some of it probably trickles down. But I think that the essence of government is that it continues to function. It's the constant. Whether you're talking about a police department or a state agency or a local governmental agency, government is built to continue to run, because the consequences, if it fails to do that, are dire. So that's why you have, you know, it's a paramilitary sort of structure, but that's why you have that structure in place and a hierarchy of supervision, so that the day-to-day continues to happen. Now, the uncertainty and the impact on, you know, morale and other things of not knowing where things are going at the top certainly has an effect. But keep in mind that everyone is well aware that there's an election coming. So there will be some certainty, and fairly soon.
Well, You know, Kim Janey believes that an acting mayor has the power to make a permanent appointment, I believe. She's going to be with us next Tuesday, I should say, to make a permanent appointment. A lot of analysts, legal analysts, don't believe an acting mayor does have that power. But if ultimately his, let's assume his appeal is denied for argument's sake next week, and she believes she has the power to permanently appoint, and let's assume she does, I'm assuming the next mayor, if it's not Kim Janey, is, and I use the term not in a pejorative way, stuck with her decision, because you can't just get rid of a commissioner because you prefer somebody else. You need cause, right? So if she, am I not right about that?
Right. But and I'm going to preface this by saying that this is your fault because both of you don't want to get into the weeds. But
okay.
You know, when you ask me a question
right.
legally, that's exactly
okay.
where I'm going to go because I live in the weeds.
Okay.
But that was the issue.
You do, literally. Live in the weeds.
Oh, that's a good one, Marjorie.
So I apologize. But the devil is really in the details.
Okay,
if
give
you
us.
Look at the judge's decision, when she talks about the removal petition and who has to hold that hearing and the
yeah.
process it's due, the removal petition says the mayor has the right to do it.
Huh.
It there's nothing in it about the acting mayor, and that's one of the things that I think Dennis White's attorney is challenging. That whether or not there is the raw authority to remove a commissioner. So, yes, and but she did, the court definitely does find that the process that's due is fairly minimal, right? It's, you know, in fact, what happened in this case was that the acting mayor called him, verbally, I think, expressed her intent to remove him, and then said there would be a hearing later that day. For him to come in and give his side of the story. And he filed the petition immediately, which stayed all of that. But I do think that's a very big looming issue, is the distinction between the duties and responsibilities of an acting mayor, which are laid out in the rules, versus the elected mayor. And that's going to be something that's ultimately going to be litigated. And I think that's why people are saying, those that disagree that the acting mayor has the authority to do this, are saying, you know, the incoming duly elected mayor should not be stuck with that decision, to your point.
I just want to point something out because yeah. this is, I don't want to say completely unique, but pretty, this is unusual, like I said about Boston, that it's the Globe editorial the other day. This is what I was talking about. There's no due process in most cities. It's just like if the President of the United States
right.
wants to fire somebody in his cabinet, the cabinet mm-hmm. member can't go to HR to protest. And listen to this. In Boston, though, the police commissioner is protected by the vestiges of laws passed by largely Protestant legislators, widely believed to be efforts to reduce the power of Irish Catholic city officials in Boston and elsewhere about, guess what? Liquor law. So, you know, even when the mayor's when the mayor was finally granted appointing power in 1962, the law required the mayor to show cause at a hearing before firing the commissioner. And that's the law White cited. But this just shows that we are unusual here, as we are in so many areas, because in a normal city, the mayor wants to fire the police commissioner, he or she can fire the
Well, you read the Globe this morning. Also, in a normal city, you vet a police commissioner candidate. You have a national search if you're in a major city, neither of which applied to Dennis White, even if he was the right choice. You know, Andrew, you didn't pick up on the following. Marjorie is probably the most competent grammarian I've ever known. And she is the most careful
okay,
user
unique.
Of the English
I shouldn't
language.
Have said that.
And she used an adjective
I
or
did.
Adverb. I don't
I
know
did.
What it is before unique,
I shouldn't
which is
have,
totally
you're
inappropriate.
Correct. It's either unique.
It's either unique
or
it
not
is not.
And you know why?
She said
it's
completely
either,
unique.
It's either one of a kind or it's not one
exactly.
of a kind. So I erred, Jim.
Do you want to apologize?
I sincerely apologize. There is no adjective before unique. Tell it to all your friends and all your children. But, you know, we all get everything
so
wrong.
So, Marjorie, just so that you know, I was sitting on the phone silently judging you.
So, Andrea, you know, I just realized so much of what we talk to you about is negative and depressing. Can we spend a few minutes and feel free to get into the weeds here? About this wonderful story about a judge who years ago had a drug dealer in front of him ready to be sentenced. And 16 years later, that drug dealer reappeared in front of him. Could you lay out what happened on those two occasions for us?
Yes. This gentleman's name is Edward Martell. Oh. And, you know, he was when he first came before this particular judge, judge's name is Bruce Morrow. In Wayne County. He was 27 years old. He had a very lengthy criminal history. He had dropped out of high school. His criminal history went back to his early teen years. He had been out on bail. He was arrested in what's characterized in the story as a drug sting.
Mm-hmm.
He pled guilty. The substance was crack cocaine, and he was looking at 20 years. And Judge Morrow sort of went a different way with him and put him on probation for a period of 3 years and basically said that among his conditions of probation was he had to come back with a significant achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he came back to the court. Let me see. He was first before Judge Morrow in 2005, came back to the court on May 15th of this year to have Judge Morrow administer, to swear him in as an attorney.
Is that
had, in that time, really took seriously Morrow's faith in him and got his undergraduate degree, went to law school, got passed the bar. Also had a significant uphill climb on the sort of the personal part of what you need to do. So you have to kind of there's a character element, which is kind of ironic given that people end up being lawyers. But there's a character element to, you know, once you pass the bar, it's not just taking the test. It's also showing that you're a person of good moral character. And he submitted a 1,200-page submission because he had to combat everything that was on his record. And they deliberated and within 15 minutes declared that this board had declared that he passed that portion of it too. And he went before and had Judge Morrow administer the oath to him, which is really just a fabulous, fantastic thing.
Here is there's a line in this Washington Post story from Judge Morrow talking about Edward Martell. He refers to him as Ed. He says, I can imagine, this is the judge, I can imagine Ed being a brown man coming from an economically depressed environment, having been chased by police, put in handcuffs, never thinking this is where the love could come from. Martell is Latino. I'll tell you, I hope there is a, this
That's
isn't
a great
just,
story.
But I hope it's a tale for other judges who don't follow the lead of people like Morrow and look for the best in people at even the worst times. But this is, to me, this is what good judges with great discretion should be able to do. It's a beautiful, beautiful story.
And can I just want to say there are millions and millions of Martells, male and female, in the system. It is an absolute lie, a longstanding lie, that people fall to one side of the criminal justice system versus the other because of some inherent disability, intellectual or moral disability. That is not what it is. And Edward Martell is a perfect example of that. I used to say it all the time when I was sheriff, is I was amazed at how many potential, groundbreaking inventors and scientists and captains of industry and sometimes geniuses were behind bars. And, you know, it kind of helps, you know, people who want to believe that, you know, people who go to jail or run afoul of the law, it happens because of some defect in moral character. That's not nearly always the case. It's nearly always a question of opportunity. And Martell, to your point, is an excellent example of what someone who has that history can do, but more importantly, what someone who's in a position to give them that opportunity could do for them and others.
Exactly. He is not unique.
Or completely unique
there
either.
There you go, Margie. That was great.
Margie's
Thank
not
you.
Going to get over this for weeks.
I'm not.
Hey,
I'm
Andrea,
not.
Good to talk to you as always. Thanks so much.
Bye,
Thank
guys.
You very much, Andrea Gabral. Andrea Gabral joins us every week for Law and Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff, Secretary of Public Safety. Now she is CEO of Ascend, where she lives in the weeds. Great to talk to you.
And it's open. Open a couple of weeks ago on Friends Street. And actually, friends who have gone there have raved about the quality of service.
Well, didn't it win that award? Third place?
Number three. It was open a week and it was number three in that poll. Yeah.
Okay. Coming up, will Massachusetts do away with the virtual classroom or not? Paul Revel joins us for that conversation on All Things Education. He's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And before we introduce our next guest, remember a day or two ago we were talking to Cy Montgomery about Pepito the squirrel that got injured.
Yes.
Somebody who called actually took care of it, then subsequently someone else took care of it. Christopher Muther wrote about it in the Globe. Well, the guy who ultimately rehabilitated him was Federico Arabia. He just tweeted the story the original story in Ours about Pepito the squirrel, which is a wonderful piece, and you can listen to our discussion and check out Christopher's great story and the injured squirrel who came all the way back. In any case, the majority of parents in Massachusetts want their kids back in the classroom this fall, but the majority is mostly white parents. According to a new Massing poll, more black and Asian parents prefer hybrid schooling. Will school districts be able to manage these competing interests? Do they even have the resources to be a school for all students? Joining us on the line for his take on this and a whole bunch of other hot education topics is the former State Secretary of Education, Paul Revel. Paul's a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. And his latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Education for Equity and Opportunity, a practical guide for school and community leaders. Hey there, Paul.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, welcome to summertime.
Yes,
to summertime.
Great to talk to you, Paul. So let's start with this weird story about this some kind of reevaluation counseling deal that's in the Boston Globe, talking about Boston high school kids. Here's what one of them had to say about this so-called counseling group. That as a Boston High School sophomore, he was pressured by the head of this district-sponsored program to attend this overnight retreat in Newton, where white adults asked this kid, a black teenager, to wrestle out his emotions on a gym mat to purge his trauma from experiencing racism. The kid was freaked out, fled to his room. Jenny Sasema, I believe is the way you're saying it, the program leader, and other participants chased after him. And for an hour, they hugged him on his bed, wanted him to go back to the counseling session while he hid under the covers screaming, "Please leave me alone." It goes on and on and on. I've never heard anything this wacky in my life. What is this thing about?
Well, I'm afraid it sounds like a cult that's gotten introduced to students via a program that was supposed to be dealing with very different topics in terms of youth activism and giving them a voice in governance and so forth. So, I'm happy that it's been uncovered, but it's shocking that it's gone on this long and this way. Students were willing to speak.
We're having Paul, we're going to put you on hold. Paul, we're going to put you on hold for a second. We have the connection's bad. We're going to call you right back in about 30 seconds, so stick around.
Well, let me just tell people a little bit more about this story that was done by Manyomi Martin, James Vanzis, and Laura Cromaldi in the Globe, that in this so-called counseling thing, students were encouraged to share intensely personal information, to cry, yell, or scream with no professional follow-up. Twice monthly sessions took place in the basement of this woman's home that ran it in Jamaica Plain. I mean, they continued for at least 15 years with little oversight by the Boston
Public Schools. Well, that's what I want to ask Paul
when
he comes back. I mean, that, to me, the most amazing part of the story, I mean, obviously the most horrible part of the story is the way these kids were treated. How did this fly under the radar?
I have
no idea. Superintendent after superintendent.
No idea.
After superintendent. Maybe Paul does, who will rejoin us.
And the woman that ran it apparently had no, according to the Globe, had no credentials to provide mental health care.
Yeah, and did she speak to the Globe, or did she embrace the new tradition where when the Globe has tough questions, or any media outlet has tough questions for you, even if you had at one point have been getting public dollars, the best way to deal with it is not to talk to them, which is
the story is very long, and I forget, I must admit, if she did talk to them
I don't think
not.
She – I'm quite sure she did not. Waiting for Paul Revel. One of the things we're going to talk to Paul about in a minute is a lot of parents saying that the solution to the learning loss – is repeating the school year. We'll get to that with Paul, and then we're going to ask you about it in a minute. Paul, before we lost you, you were mentioning what I found to be impossible to believe. I don't mean that I don't believe it's true. I just don't know how it happened. How did something like this fly under the radar with superintendent after superintendent? How's that possible?
Well, I just think, that the school system has limited capacity to monitor all the groups with which it partners across the city. And I mean, this is a challenge. I mean, on the one hand, we all want the community to be very engaged in in helping support our youth, and there are all kinds of groups that contribute in all sorts of ways. The school department has limited personnel who can go out and look into everything that these agencies are doing. So you're vulnerable to situations like this. Fortunately, they don't occur very often, but you've got here a kind of a cult operating inside a legitimate partnership activity about school governance, and I think it suggests that we need tighter scrutiny, particularly in these times when we're trying to activate more groups to help.
Yeah, you'd think, as we often say, vetting should be a little bit more rigorous.
Also, did they ever interview the kids over the years to find out what their experience was like?
So. Yeah, I mean, this is what surprises me, that that there's been no student voice on this until now, because it seems like very questionable practices for a long period of
and
time.
Damaging.
And damaging, yeah. So, Paul, we read that New York City will not allow any, and actually Jersey, I think, is the same way, all of New Jersey, I believe.
That's true, yeah.
No remote learning, no hybrid learning. It's all in person come September. Is that going to be the trend? What's going to happen here on that front? What's going on?
Well, I think there's a big push in that direction, and the State Department of Education, State Board of Education has made it clear, governor's made it clear, they expect everybody to be back in person. And in fact, 100% of elementary and middle school and 99% of high school people are already back in person in Massachusetts. I think over time, though, and we've talked about this in terms of the pandemic pods and the kind of options that parents have been finding since they've been forced into the internet world of education, that you're going to find, a certain amount of demand in some quarters by some parents and by some students for some options that enable them to get at least part of their education on the internet. And we're finding this in school systems around the country. So a number of school systems, including some in Massachusetts, as I understand it, have already indicated, Boston in particular, I gather, has asked for a waiver, as have a handful of other districts, to create an option for a limited number of students. These may be students who have disabilities that enable them to learn more effectively when they're doing it online, or it may be just open choice. But districts around the country are finding that there are a small minority of parents who really prefer this option for their children, and they're going to try and find ways to do it. So I don't think it's going to be as clean as the headlines suggest, that you're going to be, absolutely 100% in one direction. But overwhelmingly, I think we're headed back to school in person.
But I just want to clarify something for myself, and I assume for some listeners. At least the way Mayor de Blasio in New York is a graduate of Cambridge Region Latin, I should say, is putting it as there's no opt-out. I don't mean on the margins, there may be no opt-out. For the end of the spring semester, if that's what this is called, in Massachusetts, parents individually can opt their kid out. As you understand it, come the fall, will that individual family opt-out be available to parents in Massachusetts?
Yeah, my understanding is it's not going to be available to them, except under certain circumstances of waiver. So if a school district can get a waiver to offer that option to students, then they're going to have that option. I think that's how I understand.
You know what I wonder about this? Because these poor teachers, like I've said all year, that have had to be worrying about the kids sitting in front of them in the classroom and then the people at home and remote. So that means that if there are these options, that the teachers who have kids that have taken that option will be trying to teach to two different groups again.
Not necessarily, Marjorie.
No,
that isn't necessarily the way it would go.
Would it?
Where it's being contemplated now, they're talking about setting up a whole separate school that's all online for everybody who's in it, a number of teachers. And by the way, there are a number of teachers who prefer to be doing the online right now. Again, small minority, but they do exist. So putting all those people in an exclusively remote online distance learning program rather than asking teachers, and I agree with you, it's too much to ask teachers to simultaneously do both at once.
But just one last quick question about that. So if you're going to have a separate school just for the online kids and they're
Brenda
not...
Brenda Caselius told us about this the other day. We were talking about it.
Right, but there aren't that many of them. That's going to mean... I assume tiny classes, which would be great for the kids, but that's going to be a lot of money, isn't it?
Well, maybe. I mean, it just depends. You know, it depends if there's a critical mass. I think that the superintendent in Boston feels that there are enough people. You get a critical mass, you could run a school with reasonable ratios. Boston's a big district. Now, whether or not this would happen in Brookline or in some of the suburbs, or, you know, you might find that they'll do what they've done in special education, where they have small numbers who need special accommodations of one kind or another. The districts will come together and offer, you know, a statewide virtual learning yeah. option where they can pull down classes as they have in some states. And so I think we're going to see some creativity here, and that's not a bad thing. You know, as I've said from the beginning, I think the affordances that technology have given us in terms of enabling us to extend the school day, extend the school year, offer different amounts of instruction to children based on their needs, different kinds of instruction based on needs. You know, it just breaks us out of being locked into the, you know, the 180-day, 6-hour-a-day schedule in schools. And I think that would be liberating and would be, it would help us develop a sort of individualized, personalized system for each child.
I can't believe Marjorie missed the opportunity to say something like, well, as in Boston, where they're extending the school day a minute every decade. It's so by 2410. So, Paul, one of the things we're going to talk to our listeners about in a few minutes is something that one of the great education policy scholars advocated for almost a full year ago. You may remember when that scholar, Marjorie Egan is her name, suggested that the way to deal, this is true, you're the first person I know who said this, Marjorie, about a year ago, and this was obviously, we didn't know this is going to continue to go on for another year, is the only way to address this is to let people, should they choose, to repeat the school year. And as you know, there's now a great debate around this country, including in our state, with a lot of parents wanting the right to have their kid not promoted because essentially they didn't learn anything in eighth grade, they say. Why should they be going to ninth grade? Where are you on this as a matter of policy? And where are most school systems on this as a matter of practice?
Well, it's an interesting discussion, and it's not as simple as it initially presents itself. In other words, there's a lot of research that, in my view, doesn't really apply in this situation to what happens when you ask children to repeat grades. And the research says that the outcomes aren't very good. Asking people to redo a year, if you ask a kid who's had a bad experience, not done well, going through it one year and ask them to do it again, it doesn't typically spell any kind of long-term success for that child. It's not a strategy worth engaging in. But we're in a very different situation here. A lot of kids have literally missed the year. They haven't had any instruction, or the instruction they've had has been very interrupted. So they've missed a whole chunk of their education. And I think it's a legitimate inquiry that parents are making. You know, can my child have a shot at making this up? And we're not in a great rush to complete, you know, 13 years of K-12 education in exactly 13 years. You know, life is much longer these days. And what we need to do is assure that children have the competencies by the time they leave 12th grade and graduate that will be necessary for them to succeed in careers or in college. And so if it takes more time, just naturally, I mean, some kids will take more time than other kids to achieve those competencies. We ought to be that flexible, and we haven't developed that flexibility yet. That's what standards-based reform really asked us to do. And let alone if we have a catastrophe like we've had in this past year, where some kids haven't got a shot at it, we've got to be nimble and flexible mm-hmm. enough to give to all children what they need. And right now, what some of those children need is the opportunity for more instruction. So I'm in favor of having the flexibility to meet those needs.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Well, you know what educators are talking about, that there's some, that's a lot of research says that keeping a kid back can hurt them, especially the older ones. But you'd think that that stigma wouldn't be there now because of the pandemic, I would think.
Well, it's also exactly. The point that Paul made is that there wasn't a year for most of these kids. It isn't making them repeat a year. They didn't have the year.
Right.
It's allowing them to do the year they didn't have.
But I guess the argument seems not to hold in this situation.
No, I don't think it does hold. That's the evidence base that's being used to argue against it. I don't think it applies. I think there's a more practical argument against this, and this is where I think a lot of school districts are coming from, is that if a lot of people choose to exercise this option, then schools will be overcrowded because our schools are really only built for, you know, 13 cohorts, K to 12 of students. And if significant numbers decide to stay and the same numbers of kids are coming in, they run out of space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we don't really have the capacity. I mean, we're really set up as a factory model in education, which is one of our limitations and weaknesses. And so when you get a contingency like this, we're not very adaptable. And so most of the school districts are saying, gee, we're not going to encourage this because what are we going to do? We're going to be on overload.
You know, Paul, we're talking to Paul Revel. Paul, the other day or last week or whenever you were here last time, we talked about this, I was going to call it a windfall. That's probably a poor choice of words. The $400 million coming from the federal government to the Boston school system, obviously COVID-related. And I know you were appointed by Brenda Casselius to be on that committee that's advising her as to how to spend it. I'm assuming if Boston's getting $400 million, virtually every other school district is getting a proportional share based
that's
on
correct.
Their
yeah,
size.
Getting a substantial chunk of money right now. Unprecedented, really.
And I know you are in a Globe editorial in which you're mentioned prominently. You mentioned one of the great ways to spend part of it is on these navigators to help
this.
People through the system, which I was just going to say, Marty and I both love. But one of the things I worry about, which I'm sure you do too, is this is a once probably in a lifetime opportunity for these school systems to have a chunk of money, a huge chunk of money, comparatively speaking, out of their budget. Based on just the initial sense you're getting, are school systems seeing this as a chance to reimagine their educating of kids, or are they using it mostly to plug holes that pre-existed in the system?
Well, I think most school districts right now are struggling with what to do with this unprecedented windfall of money coming in. And I do think schools are conscious. I mean, the top leaders that I meet know that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to address some shortcomings or to make some changes in the way in which we do business. And we've got to use this carefully because people are going to be watching closely. One of the features of these federal grants is it's pushed really way down to the school district. So we have 13,500 school districts across the country making decisions.
Wow.
And many of them, for example, in Boston, the superintendent's initial intention is to push about half of this money down to individual principals. So there's a big worry in the field that people whisper about now, which is with all this sort of decentralization and close to the ground decisions that won't get scrutinized, that there'll be incidents of misfeasance, malfeasance, corruption in the way things get spent. These examples will get highlighted. And unless there are a number of countervailing examples of good practice, the way in which this money has been spent well, then the spigot is going to get turned off. Policymakers will justifiably say, well, we've invested a lot of money and it's gone to waste. It's been misapplied or worse, corrupted. And the spigot will get turned off and we won't get education funding for a decade to come. So I think leaders are very conscious of the importance of this moment and spending wisely, which is really, you know, in education, it isn't so much about the quantity of money you have. It's about how you spend it. Mm. And so they're trying to make strategic decisions. I think you find a mix. I mean, I think in Boston, the superintendent's trying to do a mix of, you know, of building issues, of things like libraries, of strengthening the early childhood program. And yet at the same time, even though the field is exhausted and it's hard for teachers and principals and superintendents to think about transformational change, much as people like myself are always promoting thinking about working differently and redesigning our system of education to make it more effective. This is a tough time because people mm-hmm. are worn out. So I think we'll see a few sort of broad changes. I'm hoping people will do what City of Nashville did and grab onto this notion of having a navigator.
So are we.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that we'll have a children's cabinet in each city where the mayor and the superintendent and every sort of major agency within and outside government that cares about children will come together and start thinking about what we do about health and safety and nutrition and all these factors that are non-school factors, but get in the way of kids coming to school and being ready to learn. And so it's an enormous opportunity, but has to be handled ever so carefully.
Hope so. Good to talk to you, Paul Revel.
Yeah, thank you so much, Paul. Have a nice Memorial Day.
Yes, you too. Good luck to both of you.
Paul Revel joins us regularly. He's the former State Secretary of Education, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, where he has a lot of great ideas, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you what you think about one of the topics we just discussed with Paul Revel. Should schools let students redo what has been called the lost year? In other words, go back to where they were when they left. If you were in third grade, go back to third grade. The conversation is next on 89.7 GBH. Do you want your kid to redo the school year or not? 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to Paul Revel about what has been a lost year for so many students learning remotely this past year. For kids who are getting failing grades, some parents would rather they repeat the school year rather than advance to the next grade, unprepared, out of their depth. The problem is most schools aren't having it. According to school policy, it's not everywhere, but most places, they think it's better for the kids, particularly older ones, to advance to the next grade. Of course, they're not factoring in, at least we don't think, in what has been the most abnormal year for students, for teachers, and for parents. So we're taking your calls, asking what would be the best thing for your kid? And beyond that, what do you think is the best thing for kids in general? Would doing the year over be better for them? 877-301-8970. You know, one of the lines, I tried to quote it, but I did it inadequately, in this Globe story, Vivian Cargbo is quoted.
Oh, yeah, this is a great story.
She wants a do-over for her daughter. Her 14-year-old failed all her classes this year after spending her day chatting online with friends instead of paying attention to teachers at the O'Brien School of Math and Science. As a working single mother, Cargbo looked for other ways to help her, etc. She says, heartbroken that the school's decision. In any case, here's her quote. How can she go to ninth grade if she didn't really do eighth grade? I mean, it's so and by the way, you did mention it a year ago. It's so obvious to me, as Paul said, all the research about repeating grade, none of it applies in this setting. Well, it isn't like you had a year in class and you didn't do well, so give them another chance. The kids we're talking about are kids who essentially had no year in class. And should you promote them to another grade when they didn't get the education? And in all likelihood, if that school year they missed would have been of any value, they're unprepared to go to the next grade. And which is, how intimidating is that going
to
be?
Well, one of the reasons I was originally in favor of the MCAS, which Jim led the charge to not have.
I didn't lead the charge. I was among the leaders.
Was because if you have a bad year yourself in school, or mm-hmm. you have a bad teacher, and you don't, for example, as one of these kids says, learn long division in fourth grade, you're going to get to fifth grade.
You're totally right.
And you're not going to
totally
know how to do long division. And maybe your parents have the wherewithal to go out and hire a tutor for $100 an hour, but lots of parents can't do that. So you never learn long division. What used to happen, and it's such a sad thing, you graduate from high school, and remember this story about the Gorton's fish trying to hire people?
Oh, of course
people?
I remember, yes.
This was 15 years
in
ago.
In Gloucester or something?
In Gloucester.
Is that where it was? Yeah.
And they talked about how these kids would graduate from high school not knowing how to read or write correctly and well enough to get a job working at this fish making plant. So that's the thing.
Also, once you get behind,
you just get more and more behind.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, there has been a stigma. I know, you know, that before the pandemic, there's a little bit of stigma. Oh, you don't want to, well, my poor kid had to stay back a year and stuff like that. But you're better off staying back a year. And now there's no reflection on you. It's just a reflection of not being able to do
right.
the remote
I don't think
learning.
It's stigmatizing the kid in this environment.
Not at all.
I would hope not at all. In any case, what do you think about the concept? The vast majority of administrators appear to be against it. Paul Revel, who knows more than a little bit about policy, thinks it's an option that should be available, and apparently so do Marjorie and I. Cassie in Concord, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Oh, hi, guys. I have two sides to look at it. I was a teacher, and I taught in a city school, and I had a lot of kids that were there on social promotion, which means when they arrived in fourth grade, they really weren't caught up with the rest of them. So I can see that aspect of getting them prepared to move on to the next. Then I have a very close relationship with a teenage granddaughter who had to take time off in high school to address some anxiety issues. And so she couldn't return back to her school until the following year. Now, she did try and do some work on her own and stuff. But I think the social issue is something for older kids.
Right.
Is something to look at, because when she came back, I mean, the kids were all great, but she was coming in as a junior. All her friends were seniors.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
She never really felt part, and she's graduating this year, but she never really felt part of that class. She always felt like she was just kind of, you know, in between. So I think especially for the older kids, maybe the social component.
That's a great point.
You know, it should be addressed.
Cassie, I don't know what town you taught in. You said it was an inner city school?
In Baltimore,
Baltimore.
They have in Brookline, and I think this is wonderful, and I think they probably have it in other schools that aren't broke. They have this program that allows kids who miss school because sadly they had cancer issues or they had mental health issues or they were badly injured in a car accident. They can come back to school in a special little group. They get practically one-on-one instruction to catch up from where they were. And this is, you know, in the school. They have it at Brookline High School. And I think it's one
How many urban school systems could afford
Well, I'm saying, exactly. Brookline is, and I think Newton has one too, but those are two affluent school systems. But that's the only thing I can think of really to get around that sort of situation, because you're right. How do you catch up otherwise?
Cassie, thanks for the call. You know, also, I think the answer to Cassie's concern is I don't think either of us, two great education experts, are suggesting it be mandatory. We're saying that's an option the parent should have.
Right.
And if the parent in consultation with the kid says, I'm worried about the social consequences, as Cassie was mentioning, then maybe you don't opt to repeat the year. You think that damage is going to be worse than the benefit that you get from it, but the option should be there. Harry and Quincy, welcome.
Hi. I functioned as a school counselor within the city of Boston. I work in Roxbury at the Orchard Garden School, which is an amazing school.
Oh, yeah.
The program was through Boston College. It's called City Connects, and it's a hybrid of school counseling plus social and emotional components based around the family. It's a holistic approach. So in that regard, learning occurs in a place of safety. You have to be in a place of safety before your brain is ready to accept new information. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the safety component has been fulfilled for most of the students, especially the inner city students.
What do you mean?
Food, clothing, and shelter have to be addressed also in order for learning to occur. And as far as the social component goes, society is socializing your child everywhere all the time. So a lot of the social component has been missing in some ways, but most of it has still been happening and going along. However, the education has not. And linear education is what happens in the public school system. You learn this in the fourth grade and this in the fifth grade and this in the sixth grade. So being in the school to learn in that sequential order is kind of crucial to getting the full picture education that we're supposedly providing for all the students. And if we're not going to get them safe first, it's not going to work. We're not going to be able to teach those kids.
But Harry, that's not just a function of a post-pandemic world. That's a function, what you think is necessary to educate the full kid and make him or her feel safe applies in all times, right? I mean, that's I agree. As someone who doesn't have your skills or background, I agree. If you don't meet the needs coming and gone, the kid can't learn. Harry, thank you so much for
the
call.
Well, let's not have a blanket statement. Some do.
No,
obviously.
But I have told – no, some do. But I know you don't like this kind of thing. But I told you, my friend, the late, great Kathy Kelly, who was a first-grade teacher and was president of the Boston Teachers Union years ago, when she testified in front of the legislature about funding, saying, you know, I want school funding. If you're not going to make sure my kids' bellies are full, they have a safe home life, et cetera, their neighborhood is safe, kid can't learn. I mean, it all is interconnected.
The problem I always have with that is that it says that these kids are doomed, and they're not doomed.
No, it says that they need a fair launching point. Right, it doesn't mean that no kid can survive.
There's not going to be a fair launching point.
Well, so should we ignore what Harry says?
No, but you have to say these circumstances are terrible, but this we're going to do the best we can given these circumstances to make sure that
I don't think you say that at all. I think you say let's work on fixing those circumstances.
Are you out of your mind? We have a poverty rate in the United States of America.
So you're essentially buying into the disadvantage forever by saying
I'm not buying into the disadvantage forever. I'm saying that if you have a kid right now who's in the sixth grade, who lives in a very tough situation, family situation, very tough economics, you're not going to say to that kid, hey, you can't learn. You're going to say, we're going to do the best.
Of course. Well, obviously you are. But if you don't address those other issues, average kid coming from that circumstance.
When do you think we're going to address those other issues?
Well, you're right. We're probably never going to address any issues.
Exactly. I mean, we can't even get reasonable help with childcare in the United States of America, the richest nation on earth. We can't even get people we have hunger. One-sixth of the children in America, I mean, in Massachusetts, have hunger issues?
Well, you know, even though I'm usually as negative as you, we just passed legislation that eliminated 50% of kids from who were living in poverty. So even though we don't
but
do
we
much.
We just finished talking with Jim McGovern about the hunger issues in Massachusetts.
We did, yeah.
So I don't think you want to say because you were having these issues, you're not going to be able to learn your math.
Nobody has
you
said
just finished
that.
Saying
no,
that.
Excuse me. People are saying, whether it's Harry or my friend Kathy Kelly, it is much harder kid. No one alive is saying give up on the kid because if he comes from horrible circumstances and a tough life, he shouldn't have a chance. He or she has a much higher mountain
That's
to
right.
climb.
And I would also point out that when you look at the valedictorians in high schools in Boston, what's one of the...
Yeah, they're not outliers though, are they, Marjorie?
The outliers?
The average kid coming from a really tough setting comes really, really disadvantaged.
But a lot of them come from different countries. They've come here as refugees from that
Who's got a better chance, the kid coming from Brookline or the kid coming in that valedictorian?
I'm not comparing Brookline to Boston. All I'm saying, that attitude really, I think, is not a good one.
Well, I don't think anyone has the attitude you're criticizing. Okay. Vicky Nicar, you're next. I don't think anybody says it's hopeless. Let's not do it. Vicky Nicar, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Vicky.
Hi, now, children.
Okay.
That's right. We always bicker.
We've had this debate for 20 years. But
no, you guys care, and that's wonderful. No, I was an educator for 36 years. I totally disagree with staying back in this situation.
Why?
Because every student is behind now. So what is behind? How do you define that when you put all the students back into the next grade? In September, the teacher will start from where she needs to start.
So, but Vicky, teachers, and you're one of them, we're one of them, teachers had maybe the toughest year for which they were totally unprepared of their lives. We're now saying, so when you come back in the fall and you're teaching ninth grade, you're going to be teaching some kids who are ready for ninth grade and the other half of the class really have to be taught at an eighth grade level. Is that a fair burden to put? I mean, I understand every teacher's got to deal with different levels of advancement of their kids, but it doesn't have to be everybody. Why selectively can't there be kids who suffered a severe learning loss repeat the grade? What's wrong with that?
I just don't agree because I think everybody's behind and that you have to be in the – of course, I come from the elementary.
Yeah.
I don't deal with anything over fifth grade.
We got it. We hear you. We hear you. And by the way, the school administrators agree with you, Vicky. So we're the outliers here. I guess Paul Revel and Marjorie and I are the outliers. Thank you very much for your call. 877-301-8970.
Wendy in Hingham. Thank you for calling, Wendy.
Hey, Wendy.
Hi. I just, in response to the last caller, I have to disagree because my kids are in high school, but they kept up easily, and I would hate for them to have to repeat. But I guess what I was originally wanted to say was I would love to see a program over the summer spend 2.5 months and make it optional for kids to just do the basics, math, science, or maybe even forget science, math, English, history, and have no gym, have no lunch period, but to make it affordable and maybe even have I don't know if teachers would want to come back for extra pay, or maybe just reach outside the whole union system and get people for
hire.
Well,
I don't think they're doing that. But, you know, Wendy, we talked to Brenda Caselius, the superintendent of Boston, about a week or so ago. Didn't she say that there were summer programs available for roughly 50% of the kids, I think? Was that not what she
said? I'm not sure, but I know many people have talked about how we need them, including the governor.
No, the governor pushed him big time.
So I'm not sure where Boston stands.
But I think basically, I hope people agree with you, Wendy. There have to be summer school opportunities for kids who want them and need them, regardless of whether or not we allow them to repeat.
But I think, Wendy, and thank you for the call, makes a good point, because I think a lot of kids have done well. I mean, I think.
Oh, of course.
So there's a great variety between, or among children, I should say. Anne in the car, thank you for calling.
Hey, Anne.
Oh, hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
20 plus years ago, my daughter was finishing up kindergarten, and the teacher, she was nearly the youngest one in her class, fall birthday girl, and the teacher was recommending that she repeat kindergarten, and we were really disturbed by this recommendation. You know, we didn't think she was doing that badly, but we wrestled with this decision. It was the worst decision of my life. I ended up talking to the superintendent of schools in our district, and he pointed me to some literature. He disagreed with the teacher, and he gave us some literature at that time anyway that talked about the stigma that these kids feel when they're held back like this. And we decided that, you know, she's young enough and quite resilient. We sent her on to first grade, and she did great. She had a wonderful teacher. But you know what? In that school, all the kids remembered which kids were held back.
Yep.
And
but
my daughter remembered it forever.
Yeah, but this is different, though, Anne.
There is a thing. I know.
You know, Marjorie said it before, and Paul Revel, much more importantly than us, said it before. And this is, as Marjorie just said, this is different. You know, a stigma may attach, and I'm sure does, in a normal setting, and it's sad that it does. This is not a normal setting. This is was not – nobody's lived through a year like this, so I think that's been the rule. But I just don't think the rule applies. And thank you much for the call. But you'd also agree, if the parent is worried about the stigma, the parent's worried about the social consequences, another caller said, then don't ask for the kid to be held back, right? I mean, isn't that the solution?
I mean, I think you could have a lot more parental involvement. You have a good sense of where your kid is at, and some of the people in the story are convinced that their kids – just couldn't do the remote learning for a whole bunch of reasons, and they're way, way behind.
Why do you think so many of the schools, based on the reading we did, or administrators don't want to give this a shot? If there was an option to do remote learning, and that was fine in so many places, why shouldn't there be an option for parents who were deciding, hopefully in conjunction with their kids and hopefully in conjunction with the teacher,
I think
kids not ready for the next grade?
Paul Revel touched on it, and the Globe story did too, that they point to this research that Anne was talking about the stigma involving kids, especially older kids. But as you said, this is a different – this kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
And as you said, and as he said, it is a different kind of thing. The research doesn't apply. We only have time for one more.
Okay, Diane from Rumford, Rhode Island. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Diane. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
This is my first time getting through. I'm a big, huge fan of both of you.
Thank you.
I'm very excited to be on.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a special education teacher in the sixth grade and in Rhode Island. And, I'm a little nervous.
Don't be.
it's been a really tough year because we do work with kids right now in the classroom, but we have also our computer set up where we have to work with kids online at the same time.
So hard.
I work with kids with special needs, so it's really hard. But what I wanted to mention is that part of Common Core, everything, for example, like we were talking about division is introduced in third grade, and then it goes into more in depth in fourth grade, and then it's actually repeated again in sixth grade. Every skill that a kid learns, it's gone in a cyclical of like 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I do agree with the other caller that says, because you're going to have kids that pick up right away. But I have kids in my class that maybe are in the first percentile for reading and math.
Mm-hmm.
And I have kids in the same class that might be in the 60th percentile. So I think that in our case, we are going to have programs this summer, achievement programs. Because I think that's a way. I mean, I do agree with your the person that presented this, that we also have to address what she said. He said, I think it was a social worker, about it's called Maslow's hierarchy of learning. It is. We have to be concerned about basic
needs.
Security.
Yep.
We have kids that.
Oh, yes.
Diane, I'm interrupting only because we are out of time, but thank you so much for calling. I very much appreciate it.
Thanks for your first call. We're glad you got through.
Yeah, we are.
Someone just tweeted and said, our grammar discussion was the highlight of their week. Hashtag unique. That is totally true.
Okay. Coming up, Charlotte Young from the Boston Globe, the business columnist there. She's going to talk to us up next. You are listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. Was the murder of George Floyd a wake-up call to corporate America? In the aftermath of his death, businesses pledge commitments to social change. 1 year on, does their solidarity hold up, or has it been nothing more than corporate woke-washing? Join us online for her take on this and other business headlines as Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung. Shirley, of course, is also a GBH contributor. Hey there, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey. Great to see you, Shirley. Great to see you on Zoom. So, headline on a great piece by you and your colleague, Larry Edelman, about companies taking on the challenge of increasing diversity, aiding these Black-owned businesses. What you focus on Bank of America. What are they doing?
Yeah, so Bank of America was part of a group of companies that last year pledged an insane amount of money, right, to erase racial equities. And you know, few companies did more, pledged more than Bank of America. They pledged last year $1 billion over 4 years.
Wow.
And then actually at the end of March of this year, they raised it. They're like, we're going to spend $1.25 billion now. And the centerpiece of their effort is really novel. Typically as a bank, if you want to help minority-owned businesses, you give them a loan. Right. And so so they did some research. They met with their investment bankers. They met with their market presidents. It's like, you know, what can we do differently? You know, obviously, what has worked in the past has not been as effective in terms of eliminating the racial wealth gap. And so what came back was, you know what, the time that, young businesses owned by people of color, you know, they're just getting started or they want to grow. That is the exact moment when the bank will not give them a loan. The bank is like, you are too risky, so yeah. We're not going to give you money to grow. And so so they came up with an idea of, why don't we invest in minority-owned venture capital firms? Why don't we give money to them, and then they go out and do equity investments in they find companies to fund. They find businesses owned by people of color to fund. And I love it when I interview the Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan. I don't remember one of the quotes in his story.
About Thanksgiving?
Yeah. So he said, these are the group of people who you do not want to, family refuses to invite them to Thanksgiving anymore, because when they come, they will ask you for money.
Yeah.
And so this is the group. I mean, he was saying, listen, you know, if you are if you're an entrepreneur and you're starting in, you know, let's say you're launching something in biotech and tech, you know, those kind of companies will probably, it's easier them to find funding. It's the companies, it's like the trucking companies. It's like, you know, I want to go from 10 trucks to 20 trucks. Who's going to fund me? Not, you know, venture capital firms in Kendall Square. They're not interested in my business. And so, you know, they're looking to fund the, you know, someone who needs anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000. I'm a restaurateur. I have 3 restaurants and I want to grow to 6. You know, again, Kendall Square VCs are not going to fund me. But now Bank of America is coming in. They initially set aside $200 million in equity investments in 90 minority-owned firms, venture firms around the country. They realized demand was off the charts. And so this year they decided, you know what, we're going to raise it to $350 million.
Okay.
And I did a little research on this because I wondered if overnight this makes Bank of America one of the largest institutional investors of, you know, minority venture capital firms. And my initial research shows that, yeah, probably the bank probably does become a huge factor in helping these minority firms. I mean, there's two things that happen here. They're giving money to minority-owned, minority-run venture capital firms. So now it's an opportunity to support and grow diverse fund managers, right? Private equity fund managers. And then they, in turn, give money to these small businesses owned by, you know, people of color who want to become big enterprises.
By the way, let's just continue the Bank of America commercial for about 15 more seconds. No, I'm serious. In a related note, a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, Marjorie knows him, he's been on the show, Bruce Marks, announced the other day from Neighborhood Assistance Corporation that they're quarter of a century long relationship with Bank of America, NACA and Bank of America. Bank of America is adding $15 billion for low to moderate income homebuyers through the next 6 years. You know, Shirley, before we leave this topic, though, I mean, it sounds like Bank of America is putting its money where its mouth is. I don't want to go down a long list, but were you able to step back and get sort of a big picture? Are they the outliers, or are some of the, or a lot of the big business? I mean, I'm left with the notion, we were talking about this the other day, all the big talk about racial equity, and then we go to Georgia. I know this is not money. Well, it is money. And all these corporations that were putting on their websites how much they cared about racial justice did nothing when they were suppressing votes of the same people they allegedly wanted to provide justice for. So is Bank of America, I know it's huge, but are they the norm in terms of honoring rhetorical commitments, or are they the outliers?
I mean, I think they are doing, there are other companies doing this kind of work. I think what was really interesting is last year there was focused on the dollar amount. And I think this year we're realizing it's not about the money, it's how you spend the money. And companies are being very thoughtful. And also companies were very quick to say, listen, we have not solved systemic racism. We are far from it. We are in early in our journey. We are just beginning to figure out what we've done wrong in the past. How do we correct, you know, course correct and get on the right path. So we are far from, closing the wealth gap, closing inequities. We are just at the very beginning of this journey. And I think it's good that companies and, advocates who are on this and trade groups recognize that mm-hmm. our work is far from done.
So Shirley Young, talk about closing the racial wealth gap. You wrote a column about, and it's true, the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, I've probably called them a million times over the years about, you know, how state government was cheating here and losing money there and what they were doing wrong, their taxpayer, and they would.
It's a business-backed group that does a lot of analysis and lobbying around fiscal issues.
But now they have done analysis on closing this racial wealth gap. What's the story?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, they're the group you call for comment about the state budget, right?
Exactly.
Gay finances. And this time they did something a little unusual, which is, you know, everyone talks about, again, closing the racial wealth gap. So what's at stake if we actually did it? And they calculated that if Black and Brown communities in Massachusetts, if Black and Brown college students and high school students graduated from college and high school at the same rate as their white peers, what kind of gaps could be closed, or how much more could that throw into the Massachusetts economy, you know, as one example. And they calculate if you added everything up, you know, higher graduation rates, more job stability, as a result, less dependence, less reliance on, public benefits. You know, if you take that all in 5 years, it would add about $25 billion or add about 100,000 jobs to the Massachusetts economy. And I think it's really important. They really drew a line. It's like, what, you know, this is not about, you know, feeling good, right? This is, or doing good. This actually goes to the bottom line of the Massachusetts economy and creates up to 100,000 jobs over 5 years.
Okay, so the good news is they quantified this, which I think is a helpful step. what are they going to do about it? I mean, virtually every major business organization is affiliated with them. I was hoping the next paragraph of the story was going to be, and a month later, they're going to have an action plan as to how to add that $25 billion. Is there one?
The step one was to quantify, you know, what's at stake. And step two is they're inviting, you know, business groups to partner with them. And you have to understand, a lot of groups, a lot of companies, they're already doing some element of this. And, you know, what I feel like some of the reason why we, like, what needs to happen is that people need to be more organized, that we need to all work together, and some of these efforts need to scale to make a big difference. And so I think that's, I mean, because you have to say, especially in Massachusetts, there's a lot of efforts over the years, over the decades, to erase racial inequities, but something's not working. And so I think it's a time to really reflect on what works, what doesn't, and how we all can move forward in a meaningful way.
So Shirley Young, I was saying to Jim before the show that the year and a half of the pandemic has kind of gone through phases. You know, first it was where are you going to get your toilet paper? Where are you going to get your Clorox wipes? Then it was where are you going to get your mask? Then it was where are you going to get your test? And then it was where are you going to get your vaccine? And now we've moved on happily to, or unhappily in some cases, when are you going back to the office? And you did a survey. Anissa Gardizzi, I hope I got that right, did a survey of a bunch of companies to find out when they're going, and different answers, different places.
Yeah, you know, it was really surprising when she did that, because it was all over the place, right?
I mean, all over the place.
Some companies are going back, opening the office in June, right? Some in September, some not at all this year, right? It seems like a lot of them were building in some kind of flexibility where people can work from home at least once or twice a week, perhaps more. I know the Globe, we've been told the office will open up in July. No one, you know, it's optional to come back after Labor Day. We will be expected back. You know, we're still waiting for more details on, you know, how many days we can work from home. Because one of the issues, I mean, I want to go back to the office. I mean, I am sick of working from home and multitasking. When I'm home, I also do the laundry,
right.
I vacuum, I like dust. I was like, that's it. I just want to go to the office. I just want to
sit at my desk and make phone calls. Hey, Shirley, you forgot your two young kids. You forgot that too.
Well, now they're in school now. So what are the plans for GBH?
Well, I don't want to get in trouble, so let me just say this.
I don't know. Do I know?
I do.
Okay, Jim knows.
I believe that there'll be a transitioning back after Labor Day. Let's just leave it at that. And let me ask if we can. Let me ask. I don't quite understand. I know you're not an epidemiologist. I don't understand why any of these places are not saying that as soon as people are fully vaccinated, they should start coming back to work, assuming it's a business that says we're bringing you back to work. I know there's some tech companies that are saying you never have to come back to work. Working at home is great. But if you were a company that where the you do want your workers, at least they're part time, and I think most of the world is going to be a hybrid world come the fall. What's the delay? Do you either of you understand why the world is waiting to Labor Day, to January?
I think maybe they're thinking that for once in the life of the American worker, they're going to get more of the summer off.
Employers are saying we just want to be kind to workers and let them work from home
I thought was being really kind? Eastern Bank, when they said they wanted – it all depends on the status of in-person school, daycare,
and
commuting options.
Right.
That they're at least thinking about the women who get stuck with a lot of this stuff.
Margie, you'll appreciate this. So, Jim, this is the reason why.
Why?
Summer 2020. I have already planned out my summer for 2020. You know,
21. That was last 21. Year. Yeah.
I'm sorry, 2021. I've got camps. I've got vacation.
Right.
It's intricate dance. And because back in, you know, the spring, like I started making my plans for the summer in January.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a good point.
So I can't undo those plans. I've already put deposit downs for camps. I've already figured out my sitters. I mean, summer in by itself is this you know, it's a logistical nightmare for working
parents. It is. It's so expensive.
Right. I call it the $10,000 summer.
Exactly.
You know, right? The 10K summer. And so if you imagine, like, it's very hard for working families to kind of change on a dime. And so September, at least gives me a little, you can't really change. I think it's actually, some people, like, will I go in the office in July or August? Yeah, I probably will come in just to check it out. But this is the issue for me, is that if I'm going to go in the office, you know, I also want to see my colleagues. So I think if we go to this flexible schedule.
I'm in the office and I'm seeing Marjorie, my colleague, like 4 feet away.
Hello.
Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
How are you? And John and Chelsea, too.
People besides Marjorie.
Jim's in his shorts. Looking good.
Let's not get into that. Okay.
And his sandals.
This is a great question. So when will you have guests like me back in? I'm fully vaccinated.
I have no idea.
I would like to say you can come in if you're fully vaccinated whenever you want, but I don't run the place, so I don't know what the end. We'll get back to you on that.
One last thing. I really get annoyed by this. HubSpot in Cambridge, I know it's a great company, growing company. They're not requiring vaccinations. I mean, I don't get that. Why do you want to put your workers through
this? I am with you, Marjorie.
Is BBH requiring vaccinations?
I don't know.
I hope so.
I don't know.
I'm not sure if companies can require vaccinations. That's part of the
issue.
Can I
tell you, this conversation is too aggravating. Can we move on to another topic?
Let's move
this
on,
is one of the things.
Who's vaccinated? Who's not? And can you ask?
Jim's getting worked up into a frenzy.
I am worked up into
a
frenzy.
On.
Okay, can we talk about you? Hey, you did a forum. The Globe did a forum, and you moderated it recently. On the Asian American experience in the sports world, and it included somebody who made some news this week, former Patriot lineman Eugene Chung. We have a little sound from what he had to say, and then you can expand on it. He's talking about the racism he's encountered when he's been pursuing a head coaching job in the National Football League. Here's Chung.
It was said to me, he's like, well, you're really not a minority. And I froze in my tracks going, wait, did I hear that correctly? I was like, wait a minute. Last time I checked, when I looked in the mirror, when I brushed my teeth, I was a minority. You know, so I was like, what do you mean I'm not a minority? And they're like, well, you're not the right minority we're looking for. And then that's when I just became emotionally paralyzed. Like, am I hearing what I'm hearing right now?
I love when he says, when I looked in the mirror, when I brushed my teeth, I was a minority. Fill in some facts here, Shirley.
So this is the panel that that I plugged on your show
yes.
a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so I do a lot of virtual panels for the Globe. And right after the Atlanta murders, I said to the Globe, I would love to do a panel about Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders and their experiences. And I'd love to take on sports. And so we set out organizing this panel for May, which is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And Eugene Chung, agreed to go on our panel. He was the first round draft pick for the Patriots back mm-hmm. in the 90s. If you talk to Asian Americans, in Massachusetts who are Patriots fans, they remember that moment. He's a Korean American, and it was a big deal.
One of the first Asian Americans ever drafted in the NFL for any position, right?
He's not the very first. But
I said one of the first,
He was, among the first, mm-hmm. and it was a really big deal. And, let me segue real quick. If you continue to listen to the panel, I asked him, what did your parents think of you playing football? I was like, are you the black sheep of the family? Like, I'm the black sheep of my family, being a journalist and not a doctor or an engineer. And he was saying, yeah, my brothers played cello, violin.
That's great.
They became lawyers, and I played football. And then, his parents were immigrants from Korea. And then when he explained to his dad, hey, dad, I can go to college for free playing football. He's like, what? You can go, what? I love football. I'm a big football fan. I love this country. I love America. And so he went to Virginia Tech and, playing football. And he was like the College Hall of Fame at Virginia Tech. And then one more little story. So he, So I said, what was it? So his dad got to go to the Patriots conference, the press conference, mm-hmm. when they announced him or introduced him. Mm-hmm. And he and Eugene, you know, Eugene actually choked up recounting this story on the panel about how it's like, tell us about that moment. And he said, you know, I was on my way to the press conference. I was trying to reach my dad. I could not reach him. And so Eugene, you know, I don't know if it was at Fox or whatever, he gets up, you know, he comes out, he's going to the heading to the press conference, and he sees his dad there. So I think they surprised him.
The Patriots
surprised him. He was there, and then Eugene was like, "My dad took over the press conference. Everybody was asking him questions."
Hey, Cheryl.
It was a great moment. Anyways, Eugene, I knew Eugene was going to say this at the panel, and because we were doing our prep call, and I immediately informed our Nicole Yang, mm-hmm. who was our covers the Patriots for us, and I said, "You need to talk to Eugene Chung. He's going to have a story for you. I'm certain this is a national story." And indeed, after the panel, Nicole wrote a story. We posted it online. It got picked up by all the, you know, football press. ESPN picked it up. You know, the story went international. It's a story in Europe. It's a story in Korea.
Should be.
And now the NFL is reviewing what happened.
That's great. Yeah. Boy, that's great.
Right. And it's you know, you have to think of the NFL, they have the Rooney Rule, right? And this is what's really interesting to me. The Rooney Rule says, you know, it's been modified, but the idea was that they wanted more head coaches, black head coaches. And to do so, they instituted a rule, you know, more than a decade ago, where when they're interviewing for head coaches, you have to have at least one diverse candidate. And so what was happening to Eugene Chung was that he basically, the Rooney Rule, you know, he was basically written for, you know, to diversify with black coaches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or at least that's how the interviewer interpreted it. And it's pretty, and I don't think the interviewer would think that Eugene Chung would ever go public and say this out loud, but he decided to. And this is why Eugene went on the panel. He wanted to talk about it publicly, to say this keeps happening. We, the Asian Americans, are invisible. We're not even considered a minority, but we are a minority in America.
By the way, they're not doing so hot with black head coaches either. We should just
they're
say,
not.
You
they're
know,
not
Shirley, we got to run, but before we do, you're doing something tonight that is GBH related. Could you give us a quick tale?
Yes, it's a series you've been doing all year long, State of the Race with Dan Lothian. I'm on at 7:30. I think you can still register.
Fabulous.
Great.
Shirley, it's great to see you as always. Be well.
Thank you.
Bye.
Glad to get your summer organized, Shirley. Shirley joins us regularly. She's a business columnist for the Boston Globe and a GBH contributor. Thanks again to Shirley Leung. Coming up, Rick Steves is here to keep our travel dreams alive. You're going to love this. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's time for another edition of Day Tripping with Rick Steves, virtual travel through our coronavirus world. Rick joins us every month to keep our travel dreams alive. And for the first time in over a year, these dreams may be on the brink of becoming reality. Rick, as you know, is an author, television and radio host, and the owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30 on GBH2 and his radio show Travel with Rick Steves Sundays at 4 on GBH. And a bonus, next month, his two-hour TV special, we're going to talk about it, Europe Awaits, will air on PBS on June 7th of this year. Hello there, Rick Steves.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. Nice to be with you again.
And
I
you,
know,
of course.
We can actually see you in person here, so this is very exciting. We're kind of halfway there to normalcy, Rick Steves. So before we get to a lot of good news and fun stuff to talk to you about a little bit later, we're going to talk about some more serious stuff first. You were very strong on Facebook in what you think about getting vaccinated. Please tell people what you said.
Oh, I'm just feeling really like it's, you know, we've got so many people waiting to get this vaccination going so we can put tourism back into action. And I just got my second shot and bam, it was like all my little endorphins were just doing flip-flops. They were so happy. And it wasn't a selfish thing. That was the interesting thing. I was sitting there and I thought, this is a societal happiness I'm feeling. It was the weirdest thing. When I got my shot, I thought this is joyful because as a society, we're getting vaccinated. And the only way for us to beat this pandemic is for us to get herd immunity. It's simple. It's science. I don't care what your politics are. I don't care what channel you watch. I don't care what your hangups are. This is just simple common sense. We need to get herd immunity so we can get back on track, get our lives the way we want to. And if you understand that, you realize that this ship wants to sail, but it can't sail until everyone's on board. So we need to get vaccinated. I'm speaking for all the travel dreams that are sitting here on hold. I'm thinking of all of the dreams, all the young people whose careers want to take off. And there are certain people that think, I don't know if I want to have those flu-y feelings for a couple of days after or something. Get your jab.
Forget flu-y feelings. I said to Marjorie, I don't care if my arm falls off as long as I don't get COVID. I am there. You should check it out. Rick, and not only does Rick send a beautiful message with which we are in total agreement, there's also great photos attached to this thing. I assume some of your workers around the country. And it's a beautiful thing. And
thank you. We did a kind of a public service thing where we've got 28 needles going into 28 arms.
Oh, great.
All over the country, people are wearing their Rick Steve's Keep On Traveling t-shirt and holding their passport as they get their shot. And it's sort of a declaration of independence. We will travel again.
So, Rick, on a related note, but not nearly as upbeat, I want to quote you to you from something you wrote a mere 12 years ago. I tell people Europe's my beat. I consider it the wading pool for world exploration. It's where the big market is as I'm running a business. And my personal curiosity takes me endlessly back to Europe. It's where I find both my genetic and cultural roots. But you continue. But when asked my favorite country, I say India. We all know what people in India are suffering through as the United States is moving in a positive direction, you know, 4,000 plus deaths a day, low vaccination rates. Explain your relationship with India.
You know, I love the way travel can rearrange your cultural furniture. It can wallop your ethnocentricity. It can humble you. It's so important that we Americans realize the world's not a pyramid with us on top and everybody else trying to figure it out. We're 4% of this planet. It's a cool 4%. But there's 96% out there, and a big part of that percent is the Indian subcontinent. And when you travel to India, it is just, it humbles you. I thought I knew music, for example. I'm a pretty good musician. You go to India, they have classical music that's just as sophisticated and beautiful as ours that totally ignores meter and mode. I mean, you know, if you think you know cut time or 3/4 time or 4/4 time or 6/8 time, doesn't even apply to Indian music. If you think you know minor and major and even Aeolian modes, nope, it doesn't even apply. So I just was really humbled that to me, it sounded like noise, but when I learned it, it sounded heavenly. And I flew home with a sitar. But this is what travel does. Travel, you know, a lot of people try to avoid culture shock. For me, culture shock's a blessing. It's the growing pains of a broadening perspective. And that's something we can all use a little more of, especially Americans and people who live in countries that tend to think they're the norm. You know, it's not the norm. It's our way. And in India, you learn that even love and pain and time and music and all these so fundamental to our lives sort of feelings, they're different. And when you go there, you know, a lot of people say have a safe trip. I think part of that have a safe trip might be don't change your way of seeing the world. It'll mess up everything. But that's what I like to do when I travel. And India is the king of that.
Rick Steves, I wonder if you've heard from any of your tour guides or associates you've made in the years over there during this latest tragedy with COVID.
Oh, well, in India, it's a very difficult thing. I mean, it's a society with over a billion people, and they've got, you know, the same kind of problems we've got, but probably complicated because of the difficulty in a developing world country. But we got to remember, India has a huge middle class. I think, you know, with the way their society works, you've got this pretty rigid caste system, and you've got the elites, and you've got seas of poor people. But what you have now that you didn't have a long time ago is a middle class, probably with as many people in it as there are in the United States of America. And well, no, let's say over 100 million people anyways. And I think the irony is that India is producing vaccinations and exporting them, but they're having a hard time getting their own society vaccinated. And this is going to be, I'm sort of coming to the acceptance that the world is so divided that, yes, the United States will get herd immunity, and yes, Europe will get herd immunity. And in my world, in my business, we just want to get travel going across the Atlantic. But that's the developed world. That's the rich world. And, you know, what they used to call the third world, I think of as the two-thirds world now. You know, it's the majority of people. They'll be after us. So, okay, rich people get it first, and we get to travel and all that. But let's not forget that we may be aggressive enough to take the vaccinations first, but let's not think the job is done until the world is vaccinated. And that's just a practical reality. You can whoop it here, and if it's still raging south of the border, it can blow right back in. And it's got to be win-win when it comes to getting this this handle on this pandemic.
You recognize the voice. Of course, it's Rick Steves. Rick, you've done a lot of traveling in the Holy Land and this week, and not this week, for many, many days now. Mm-hmm. People have been riveted to the ongoing battles mm-hmm. over there, which is, happily there's a ceasefire right now. But you did a special a while back, and I wanted to play people a little sound from your interview with some Palestinian women, university students. We'll mm-hmm. play this, and then you can tell us about traveling over there in the future. In this clip, these Palestinian women are talking about what it's like living behind the wall and the constant checkpoints that have been established by Israel.
It's like I don't see the whole of my country. I can't go to Jerusalem also. I can't go to the sea. I can't see the sea. And if I go inside the West Bank, then
you need to have a permit in order to go in there. And you have this permit maybe once a year. You can have it whenever you want. For no reason.
Also,
just
I'm
like
a refugee.
That, in the name.
Yeah. I'm a refugee. I don't know my country. I'm from Bejibreel. Uh-huh. It's near Hebron.
Okay.
And I don't know my country.
Because it's on the other side of the wall.
Yeah.
You're doing a series on Facebook from some of your travels and interviews, are you not?
Yeah, I should mention that was from the time we went there to film our one-hour show that airs on GBH, and it's still available online and so on. It's just the Holy Land, mm-hmm. Israelis and Palestinians yesterday and today. And I wanted to give Americans a dual narrative understanding, the best you can in an hour special, of what's going on in the Holy Land. And I can just see those beautiful young co-eds at this university, the best university in Palestine. Their futures were ahead of them, and they're living like animals in a cage, frankly. And you can say, well, their uncles were doing terrorist activities or what. There's all sorts of, you know, realities that we have to deal with. So it's complicated. But you've got 5 million people like those girls who have no future. Their whole lives are controlled. Their water is controlled. Their borders are controlled. Who can come into their country is controlled. Their economy is totally controlled by Israel. And Israel has to reckon with a reality. I mean, there's 14 million people in the Holy Land. That's the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. Half of them are Palestinians. Half of them are Israeli Jews. And it's divided between Israel and Palestine. In Israel, you got 9 million people, 7 million Jews, and 2 million Arab Israelis. Mm-hmm. And in Palestine, you got 5 million people, 3 million in the West Bank, and 2 million in the miserable Gaza Strip. You know, Gaza is a messy situation. Palestine, it's a little more straightforward. But overall, in that area, it's 50-50, 7 million Muslim and 7 million Jews. And Israel has to decide. They've got three ways that I can see it. A viable two-state solution that puts Israeli security first, but recognizes that Israeli cannot be secure unless 7 million Palestinians have dignity. Or you can have a one-state solution. And if it's a one-state solution, it's going to be a democracy, a pluralist democracy. And the Palestinians have a far greater growth rate than the Israelis do. So you're going to have, if it's a democracy, it's not going to be a Jewish state. It's going to be dominated by Arab Muslims. And or you can have a one-state solution that is kind of an apartheid state, which is the kind of situation they've got now, if we're going to be candid. So Israel has to choose on that. And I think what's best for Israel is what they are shutting the door on. It's a viable two-state solution that protects their security and gives Palestinians a little bit of coastline, a little bit of economy, a little bit of opportunity to succeed and guarantees security for Israel.
Rick Steves, what's it like to travel to the Holy Land? How difficult is it to get into Palestine?
It's easy to get into Palestine. The Lonely Planet Guidebook to Palestine is a good seller. A lot of Americans think places like Iran and Cuba and Palestine, you can't go there. It's Americans are discouraged to go there, but they're big destinations for travelers globally, and there's a lot of first world travelers that go there. I think any Christian group going to the Holy Land on a you know, one of these Bible tours, and there's a lot of them, and I think they're great, they need to get both narratives. It's got to be dual narrative, and the standard way is they stay in Israel with Israeli guides, and they make a quick little nervous beeline to Bethlehem, which happens to be in Palestine, and they see the Church of the Nativity, and then they scamper back into safety into Israel. You need to sleep in Palestine, or you're not going to understand it. And remember, when you go from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, you could bicycle from where Jesus was supposed to be born to where he was crucified in 20 or 30 minutes, but there's a wall there that keeps the people apart, and the difference is like San Diego to Tijuana, but worse. I think there's a tenfold difference in per capita income, $30,000 a year here, $3,000 a year there. It's a sad situation, and it could be so much better. And if you spent a couple days in Palestine talking to Palestinians, you would understand there's a wall there. The wall was built to protect Israel from terrorist incursions. Okay, even if you accept that, the non-intended consequence of that wall is that the young people have no option but to live with the baggage and the fears of their parents, and they don't have an option of talking to each other. The young people want to talk to each other, but they can't. I had an Israeli Jewish guide and I had a Muslim Palestinian guide. They had a hard time even finding a place where they could park their cars next to each other so I could move from one car to the other when it was time to cross the border. It's designed to keep people apart so you can keep people with that unfortunate baggage and keep this tragedy going. And it's a complicated tragedy. In Hebron, you go to the one patriarch of both the Jews and the Muslims, and it is the tomb of Abraham. And Abraham has bulletproof glass halfway around his tomb, a synagogue on one side under the same roof and a mosque on the other side under the same roof, with people worshiping the same guy from 3,000 years ago with bulletproof glass separating them. And then you look at the humanity of it, the wonderful people in Israel and the wonderful people in Palestine and the hopes and dreams of the younger generation and this stupid wall and this stupid insistence on keeping the struggle going and settling Israelis in Palestine and denying the Palestinians their historic capital to share a little bit of Jerusalem. And we've got a lot of problems coming down, and the United States of America is a stakeholder. We're funding it.
By the way, one last thing. I want to make a big recommendation. I know Marjorie does too. The Facebook series you're doing puts a human face on a situation that we often only see with Hamas and Netanyahu. It's just you do get to see the wonderful people, to use your words, and
on both sides.
On both sides.
On both sides, Jim. And it's a seven-day series I'm running at Rick Steves on Facebook. But people can go to our website and hear that anytime, along with watching our 1 hour TV special and my 2 hour lecture on the region. But it's one of the things I really treasure is the opportunity to get this two narrative view of this. And that's all free, and it's all for the love of let's get it together so we can travel there. I would love to take groups to the Holy Land. It's such a beautiful place to travel.
So we're talking to Rick Steves, the prolific Rick Steves.
Prolific,
so
I guess so.
7th, Europe awaits. And I assume this is a transition, because I've been reading that you are getting closer. We remember talking to you last year about having returned the deposits of, what was it, 25,000 families. The situation is not quite at 180 time, but it's beginning to look a little more optimistic. Come early 2022, late 2021, what's your sense, Rick Steves?
Yeah, you know, I've just been meeting with my staff. I've got 100 people on my payroll, and we've got no revenue, so we are chomping at the bit to get going again. Yeah. I've got 20,000 people whose names are on wish lists for our tours, but we're being very patient. And I think patience is important the way we're doing this. I don't want to rush this. I don't want to be the first out of the gate. It's so much heartache to plan a trip and give a deposit on a trip and then have to cancel it, and we don't want to do that again. But we really feel that right now, we are on a glide path to normalcy. If people on both sides of the Atlantic can just get vaccinated to that point, and we're getting there as we see our society opening up today. Europe got off to a rocky start. We got off to a bit of a rocky start. Now both societies are on track. it delayed us several months. And we were hoping for this summer, but I don't think that's going to happen. But I told my staff, I'm not going to be jumping in there when one country opens up. Like right now, I think you can go to Cyprus and Greece and Iceland. No, for me, Europe is not open until all of Europe is open. Social distancing and good travel have nothing to do with Rick Steves' travel. I don't fly all the way to Amsterdam to have dinner in a bubble so I don't get somebody else's germs. I go to Paris to have my cheeks kissed. And I don't know about you, but I go to Rome to have a gelato on the piazza and packed in with the people and do the passeggiata down those pedestrian boulevards. And I go to the pubs and I like to clink glasses with people who really believe that strangers are just friends you've yet to meet. So we've decided we're going to start selling our tours next week and we're going to take deposits, but we're going to do the first tours at this point in February of 2022. Later, if it opens up, we will try to sell a few tours later in 2021. But I am feeling very confident that individuals can travel later this year and tour organizations can responsibly open things up early next year. But what we're excited about is this two-hour special you mentioned, and it's airing on WGBH on June 7th at 7:30. That's Monday, two Mondays from now. And it's called, I love the name, Europe Awaits. And so do we, you know. And there's going to be a warm and hearty welcome when we go there. And I've cobbled together six destinations that I think are just perfect for your soul and to stoke your wanderlust. And to remind people, you don't need to have the Instagram approach to Europe and just go to the famous places with all the crowds. But it's more important than ever to get away from the crowds, the small towns, the rural lifestyles, the embracing nature. And we can do that.
So, Rick Steves, for those of us whose wanderlust needs some stoking, and I know that at least two wanderlusts in the studio are in that category, can you give us a three-minute version of a two-hour special? Oh. I know that's a hell of come on, give us a little feel, you know, of these six communities in advance of June 7th.
Jim, that's something I'm pretty good at because we Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world, and we always want to see a lot in a short amount of time, but 3 minutes, okay. Well, what we're going to do in 2 hours, the show is called Europe Awaits, and it's going to be, as I said, Monday, June 7th, right on GBH, but it's got six destinations. Sicily is one, and Italy is my favorite country, and I always say if you like Italy as far south as Rome, go further south because it gets better. Mm. Sicily is like Italy in the extreme, and I was just there with one of our groups, and the food in Sicily is amazing to a great extent because Sicily is a layer cake of civilizations. Over the last couple thousand years, there's been 10 or 12 different major civilizations, and they've all left their flavors there. You can do fun stuff. I made friends with a Capuchin monk, and I had a cappuccino with him. Cappuccino is named after the Capuchin monk, and that was cool. Next, we're going to go to Mykonos. We're going to jump ship in Mykonos, and that's what I did once. I was enjoying my cruise, but I thought, I want to let all the tourists sail away. And I'll never forget sitting on the beach in Mykonos, watching that cruise ship sail into the horizon. The sun was setting, just me and my cloudy glass of ouzo, and everybody's made their money. And now we can relax and have a little bit of island time. Then we're going to have an alternative by going up to the Cotswold villages. And that's 2 hours west of London. And this is where the English people go to get back to nature. And as a travel writer, I tend to overuse the word quaint. And I save my use of the word quaint for the Cotswolds. This is the thatched village wonderland where people, there's so many beautiful walks and where people just, it seems like people come with dogs. I mean, it's just like that's what people have is a dog on a leash. And everybody's out walking through people's farms and having a lovely time in the pubs. Then we're going to go to northern Portugal. And the point I'm going to make here is we need to focus on the second cities. Everybody goes to Edinburgh. What about Glasgow? Everybody goes to Munich. What about Hamburg? Everybody goes to Paris. What about Marseille? And everybody goes to Lisbon, which is a great city. But we're going to go 2 hours north to Porto. And Porto is the second city of Portugal. And it's got a rough edge. It's got a patina of age. And it's the hometown of port wine, that velvety, beautiful wine. And we're going to go to a Quinto, a vineyard up the Douro River Valley, and drink some port with the people whose family has made it for generations. Then we got two more stops on our trip. We're going to go to Tuscany, and people love Tuscany. And what I like about Tuscany is the Tuscan lifestyles in the farm communities and the little hill town villages. And we're going to follow a cypress tree lined lane up to a farmhouse bed and breakfast where you get to know the family and where people are really into what they call slow food and a 0 kilometer meal. And you sit down with the family and you eat food that was right from that village, right from that valley, a 0 kilometer meal. And then to remind people, you could never exhaust Europe of what it has to offer. And I've been trying to do this for 40 years now, and I haven't just begun, is we're going to go to a remote corner of Romania. right on the border of Ukraine, and we're going to find a traditional society that feels like you've paid admission and walked into an open-air folk museum, but it's the real thing. We're going to dip a bucket deep into a well with an older woman whose family has drawn water out of that same well and throw that water into a horse trough. We're going to ride a donkey cart. We're going to pitch in with a pitchfork, and we're going to go to dine and spend an evening with a family that just can't stop playing their fiddle and singing.
But great.
The point about this is it's accessible. It's waiting. You don't need to be a TV host or a guidebook writer with a big camera to do this. Anybody can do that. That's what I love about public television. It's not lifestyles of the rich and envious. It's lifestyles of you and me. It's people's travel on people's TV. And we'll bring that to Boston on June 7th with Europe Awaits. And thank you for, I had a fun time just thinking through that. I want to go to each of those.
Me too. That sounds fantastic. And then I can tape it and watch it over and over again as I travel to each country down the line, Rick Steves.
I've been doing the same thing. It's Europe Awaits. And it's just a reminder that, you know, Europe is struggling with the same challenge that we are right now. And they're having the same frustrations. And why aren't they taking their shots? And what's this government doing? And so on. But Europe has really had a wake-up call in the last couple of months. And I do believe they're getting it together and realizing they got to do this in a coordinated top-down way. And they got to get serious about it. And they are. And that's very good news.
Boy, that was a hell of a 3 minutes, I'll tell you. Expand that to 2 hours. Rick Steves, we'll see you on TV on June 7th, and we'll talk to you next month. Thanks so much for your time.
You guys are great. I just love talking with you, and we can say happy travels is just around the corner.
Just fabulous. Around the corner, Rick Steves. Thank you so
much. Be well,
much.
Rick. Stay safe.
Okay, take care.
Bye. Rick Steves joins us every month. He's an author, TV and radio host, the owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30, right after Jim's show here on GBH2, and his radio show as well, Travel with Rick Steves. That is every Sunday at 4 o'clock right here on 89.7 GBH. Next month, on June 7th, as we just mentioned, you can catch this great two-hour TV special, Europe Awaits, Sicily, Mykonos, Cotswolds, Northern Portugal, Tuscany. Check your local PBS station for showtimes. Rick Steves, thanks again. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for pastry chef Joanne Chang, labor activist Dolores Huerta, and chef and TV host Marcus Samuelson. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, Miles Smith, and Dave Goldstein, who run our remote studios. Okay, Jim, what's on TV? You going to wear your shorts on TV?
That's not funny. But before we, and it's also nobody's business, I mean, if I may. Let me just say first, ending a show with Rick Steves.
Snazzy sandals.
Does it get any better than that, by the way?
Oh, my God.
So
I'm
perfect.
So inspired. Very
in
happy.
Any case, I'm off tonight. Adam Riley sitting in. I'm told he has a terrific lineup. I would watch, if I were you, that's 7 o'clock on Channel 2, Greater Boston. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks again for tuning in. Have a great day.